Hello there. It's Radio Free Nintendo episode 185. We've got the whole crew here, all four of us. John is back.
Hey.
Welcome, welcome, sir. He's charged up with all kinds of Nintendo goodies to talk about. And of course, we have James.
Hey.
And Greg.
Hello.
And the Fonz. Hey.
And the other Jonathan.
Surprise guest star, Henry Winkler. Oh.
We'll jump the shark later on in the show.
John, you can be Jonathan number one. I'll be Jonathan number zero.
Done.
Okay. Sometimes I wonder, like, when new listeners start getting on the show, like, do they get our names confused or something sometimes? Because we call you John and me Johnny, but really we're both Jonathan. And that's what I go by day to day.
See, I'm starting to go by John. I'm kind of making this lifestyle change. I've become John.
Oh, really?
Jonathan's like too...
too hoity-toity.
Yeah. Jonathan's, you know, it's a little bit too, you know, sipping the cup of tea with the pinky up kind of thing, you know?
Oh,
I'm just saying, John.
I think you need to shorten it to one letter.
Too polysyllabic.
Yep. I look at John as more like a brand. It's a branding thing.
Oh.
Wow. This show is awesome. Okay.
Sorry, off the rails.
So we're going to start with a brief discussion of the Nintendo Media Summit that happened last week. There's actually a couple of them, in depending on what region you're in, but... Nintendo of America, I think, started off with a series of announcements, some pretty major, some more minor, I guess. Some of them kind of we expected, but they had a big thing out in San Francisco, and our own Aaron Kaluska was there. He got to play Mario Galaxy 2 and Metroid Other M, among a few other things, and those impressions I would think would be up by the time you hear this. We had a really, really good live blog of the announcements as they came down, as, you know, Cammy and Reggie and Bill Trennan and people like that were up kind of talking about all this stuff and demoing the games. And then they had a several hour long play session for these people, and I haven't heard a whole lot from Aaron since the event, but I know at one point he accidentally had lunch with Reggie.
Mm-hmm. Accidentally?
As you do.
Yes, it happens. The last time I saw Reggie in person, I was at Nintendo of America headquarters in Redmond, and there was a fire alarm or something, and so we all had to rush out of the building, and so we ended up hanging out with Reggie in the parking lot, just shooting the bull. So I have kind of a similar experience, maybe a little more dramatic than his.
I have not got to hang out with Reggie, but I have stood right next to him filing out of the Pepsi Center in Denver at the convention.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. How random is that?
I just turned around and there he was. It's like, what the world?
I remember this, yes. I remember you mentioning that. But anyway, in terms of the announcements, I don't have a full list at hand, but I can certainly give you the high points. I mean, the two biggest announcements were that Super Mario Galaxy 2 is coming out in May in America, and pretty much everywhere else too, I believe.
It's June 11th in Europe, so about 2.5 weeks after, which, you know, the grand scheme of things is pretty good, but that could be a long 2.5 weeks for me.
It could be, yes, indeed. And then Metroid Other M is coming out in June in North America, so only 1 month after.
Well, and in between those, I think, what was it, June 7th, Sin and Punishment 2? So
that's right.
Within about a month, Mario Galaxy 2, Sin and Punishment 2, Metroid Other M.
Yep. It's going to be rough.
Never afraid to cannibalize your own sales.
I'm pretty glad I've already played Sin and Punishment 2 at this point, actually.
Yeah, it really opens up your schedule.
Although it is actually coming, Sod's Law, that's the one that's coming out first in Europe. It's coming out in early May. Other M looks like it's going to be in that August-September slot that we're more accustomed to seeing Metroid in Europe. So that could be tough.
Yeah, it seems like there might be a lot of localization work to be done on the game.
Yeah.
From what we know now.
Stupid
Frenchies.
From
what we really suspected before. But I guess a couple other quick announcements were stuff like Nintendo's going to publish Dragon Quest IX this summer in North America, so that it won't be published by Square Enix, oddly enough. It's not unprecedented for Nintendo to do something like that, but who knows why they chose to go that route. But it is coming out this summer, finally, in English. Let's see, Monster Hunter Tri, it's coming out in early April, am I right?
April 20.
Yeah.
Okay.
So late April.
The interesting stuff there is that in the first week of March, you'll be able to, in America at least, you'll be able to pick up a free demo disc at GameStop. And apparently you just walk in and grab it and leave if you want to.
Yep.
run out if you act like you stole something.
Well, that's the thing. That's kind of the idea, actually, because they want you to get it play it and then come pre-order it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, they've also announced a pre-order bonus that if you pre-order Monster Hunter Tri, you will get 500 Nintendo points, which can be converted into either Wii points or DSi points. And I assume you would pick those up when you actually collect the game.
I would think so, yeah.
In
yeah.
April.
Is there downloadable content in this game?
There probably will be. I know in the PSP one they have downloadable quests, I think, that they put out on. Mm-hmm. They put out every couple of weeks. So
see, I was wondering if putting that together with the points is a is a sort of here's your taste of your downloadable.
Yeah, well, the one thing
spending.
You won't be spending the points on is a subscription service like they have in Japan, because it is going to be free to use.
Well, the quests on the PSP are free. You just download them and. But,
right.
I think the Wii Points card is supposed to be a collectible Wii Points card, supposedly. So I think it will be.
I mean, it makes
have a
sense because all you need is
something.
The code off of it to redeem it.
It'll be a big monster.
And so that game's going to be free to play online. Of course, they are also adding Wii Speak, so it's going to be a significantly altered package, I think, for North America. And it sounds like Capcom's really pushing it. Now, supposedly, I kind of made a joke in the forums that Nintendo could really learn how to sell a Wii game from Capcom.
Depending on the Capcom game you choose.
There you go.
Zach and Wiki, hello.
Yeah. But, hey, they certainly didn't have a free demo disc for Zach and Wiki. I don't know if that would have helped.
Yeah,
but,
true.
But supposedly, they've been getting a lot of marketing help from Nintendo, which is kind of curious because it seems like they're throwing a lot of ideas at marketing Monster Hunter mm-hmm. that Nintendo hasn't really used before.
Yeah.
So it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out. But, I mean, it definitely amped up my personal interest in picking the game up, you know.
Mm-hmm. I do have to put in a dig at Capcom for bringing out Street Fighter 4 on the iPhone and not the Wii.
Thank you.
That's pretty awesome.
That's pretty bad.
That is mind-bogglingly stupid.
Well, as you know, the sort of on-screen controls are far better suited to fighting games than the classic controls.
Yeah, there's no way in hell that game's going to play well. It's just not possible.
Well, anyway, let's talk about Mario and Metroid here. They're the two biggest announcements out of this summit, and I'm sure we all have some thoughts on them.
Do you want to declare victory now, Johnny?
That's what Johnny really wants to do.
I mean, in terms of release dates, yeah, I think Greg and I were really on point with this.
Well, let's clear up any ambiguity right now. Let's rewind it back to the episode On the Table.
I'm expecting Mario to be a summer release, and by that I'm talking May or June.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I know there's a little bit of contention here among our crew.
A little bit, yeah. In that I'm right and you're not. That is the contention.
Assuming that the Zelda doesn't come out, what are you predicting is going to take its place?
You can't predict anything. There's nothing else.
No, I can predict because I don't see Galaxy coming out this summer.
So, yes, clearly James was convinced that Galaxy was going to be the holiday title, which it now is not, so we win.
And, you know, knowing Nintendo, there's a very good chance that either or both of these games could be delayed, but I wouldn't expect more than a month, you know, in
either
case.
Yeah, it's too close now as well.
They're too close, and they're very firm release dates. I mean, they're very specific.
They have a date, which is unlike a normal release idea.
Right. It's not like
I mean, sometimes happens, like, what was it, Brawl USA date went back a couple of weeks, pretty close, but that's all it was.
Yeah.
Right, that's usually production issues or something.
Yeah.
Or a last-minute bug fix.
And, I mean, Metroid's sooner than I thought. I mean, really. I mean, we were looking at August. I mean, I'm really quite shocked that it's that
in
close.
In June, yeah. That's the one that I would think is more likely to slip. But, yeah, Galaxy 2, you and I both thought, Greg, that it would probably be out in May or June. And so that wasn't a big surprise to me. But, you know, and especially when we started to hear inklings that Metroid would actually be at the summit, I thought, oh, yeah, that's coming out this summer. But I still didn't think it would be June.
No,
I still don't necessarily think it will be June. But, you know, July. And
well, the thing is, that's
be,
the one
that's
game
fine.
That we really haven't heard much about how far along it was.
No.
It was kind of a wild card.
No one had played it until the summer either.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really probably one of the most interesting things that's come out of it for me is you know, the first sort of gameplay details on it. And it turns out James and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago about the idea of, you know, using it sideways, the remote, and then pointing at the screen sort of a bit like Super Paper Mario or whatever. It turns out that's
exactly like
what it's going to control like. It's really, I mean, to be honest, even though we discussed that possibility, I'm still surprised because I thought with, you know, the mix of gameplay styles that were hinted at, you know, the flexibility of an analog stick, nunchuck Wii Remote setup would have been the most obvious choice. And also, I mean, you've seen, you know, with Blaster Master Overdrive, you know, some of the problems of executing a sort of traditional Metroid kind of 2D controls with limited buttons on a Wii Remote held sideways. So I thought it's an interesting idea. Obviously, that's why we talked about it. But in the end, you know, would they really do that? And it turns out they are. And that's interesting. I guess some of the way they're getting around it apparently is a lot of auto-targeting when you're shooting. Yeah.
And the other thing is apparently you can only use missiles when you're in first person. So, you know, eliminates the need to have a button to switch back and forth between different weapons.
Yeah, because, I mean, of course, Zero Mission mainly plays out on a D-pad and two buttons, but you've got the shoulder button modifiers, which are kind of crucial for shooting diagonally and switching out the missiles. And, of course, so what they've done is they've basically taken out those things, so the missiles are only in first person, and then there's no need to kind of manipulate diagonals and stuff on the shooter because it kind of does a lot of that for you, and I think it's going to throw a lot more enemies at you, so it's going to be more kind of intense and frenetic than it was before.
It's really interesting. I read some impressions of Other M from the people who actually played it at the summit, and I was, you know, a little torn in that it sounds like the action is really fun, and it sounds like, you know, it's very difficult to demo the best parts of Metroid in 30 minutes or whatever. It's just hard to feel a grasp for the structure of the game, and Metroid in particular is a game where I feel like the structure is the best part about it. So that it's almost, in a way, it's completely different, but it's as difficult, I think, as demoing an MMORPG or something like that. It's just, you can't really take a slice out of it that's indicative
of what it's actually like. It is more of a sort of extensive experience in terms of how it really satisfies. You know, it's not, what do they say about Halo, the same few minutes of fun over and over again?
Yeah. It's Metroid is more of a slowly unfolding blossom.
Yeah, I mean, now with the story too, I mean, with the increased story element, who knows how they're going to give that story to you? Is it going to be in big cutscenes? Yeah.
Well, it's definitely going to be cutscenes, but how much of a percentage of it is going to be, I don't know. But
yeah, I'm kind of worried about that.
Mixed things about some of the voice actors. So Jeremy Parrish wasn't particularly impressed with Samus is sort of sounding disinterested as she's narrating this stuff. I mean,
well, I wouldn't want her to sound like a cheerleader.
Well, yeah.
I mean, Samus seems like a pretty disinterested kind of a character.
Yeah, I mean, I guess some ways it's appropriate in terms of, like, if she's looking back on it and she's, like, cold and dispassionate, but at the same time, it's got to sound like you're not just sort of phoning it in off the script.
Well,
either.
Yeah, as long as it's not Day of Crisis, I'm totally cool with it.
save that for... We'll get to that in a minute.
Sorry.
I mean, I assume it's not Jennifer Hale doing the voice, who did, like, the grunts for Metroid Prime, basically.
Yeah.
But Jeremy Parrish would have spotted that, because I know he likes the voice acting in Mass Effect, so I assume it's not her.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, from what I read about the story in terms of, you know, Commander Adam Malkovich being involved and the Galactic Federation stuff, and it sounds like Other M is pretty much a direct continuation from Super Metroid, so this might actually be like the real Metroid 4 instead of Fusion. Fusion started out as Metroid 4, but
it really is like very much like a prequel to Fusion as well, though. I mean, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
I guess if this is Metroid 4, Fusion's Metroid 5, because it's very much like setting up the backstory of Fusion.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's right after Super Metroid, and from everything I've heard, it's like, yeah, this sounds like this kind of stuff that Sakamoto was interested in exploring in Fusion. So story-wise, it sounds a lot like Fusion in terms of, you know, these characters involved and Samus being kind of self-reflective and etc. Action-wise, it does sound considerably different, not only from Fusion, but from kind of everything. I mean, it's weird because it does sound like it's very fast, very action-paced, kind of what you would expect with Team Ninja's influence, you know, and their involvement here. But apparently pretty much all of the classic Metroid elements have been kept, including, you know, Morph Ball and bombs and finding secret missile upgrades and stuff. It's really hard to tell how much it will actually feel like Metroid, because you're not going to get that out of playing it for half an hour.
No, it's really interesting, the idea of using the first person perspective, not just for, like, you know, taking down enemies or, you know, delivering the missiles, but also scanning the environments, you know, looking for secrets, sort of bringing a bit of kind of Metroid Prime style looking for secrets into the kind of 2D structure of the old Metroids. That could be an interesting sort of synthesis of the two strands that we've seen before.
Yeah, I really hope there's a lot of heavy scanning. I mean, that's one of my favorite things with the series now is the fact that they kind of build this whole backstory through the scanning. It just kind of wouldn't feel like a Metroid game if it didn't have that now.
All right, well, we should probably move on to Galaxy 2 before we end this little piece here. So we found out it's coming out in May, which is sooner than a lot of people, including James, thought would happen. other than that, I don't think there were any really shocking revelations here.
No.
I feel like the main takeaway I got from the impressions is that there might actually be a lot more Yoshi in this than we've seen lately in other Mario games, including New Super Mario Wii and Sunshine.
Yeah,
and it sounds like he's actually like an integral part of the game. He's not going to be in every level. Unfortunately, it's not something like you can just get him as a power up and carry him around.
It certainly doesn't look that way, does it? No.
But he's not on a timer, which is good. They're showing a lot of levels with him in it so far, so that's
yeah.
What's
really
indication.
Cool about it is just that this was suggested before, but now you're seeing it much more explicitly and how it will be used is the pointer and his tongue. So all the different stuff you could do, like they showed a bit of a boss where you know you can eat a bullet bill with Yoshi's tongue using the pointer and then spit it back out at the boss using the pointer. You could use it to interact with the environment and you know to latch onto platforms. All this kind of stuff. You know, really, you're bringing the unique Wii features into the gameplay in a much more meaningful way than just the kind of, you know, peripheral star bit collecty stuff that you had before. So Yoshi, it's only cool, you know, if you like Yoshi like I do, to see him sort of become like an important part again. But it's also you're really making use out of the Wii features in a way that Galaxy didn't. So it's something you'd like to see on both levels.
Yeah, it really screams like it's something that they really wanted to put into the first game but just couldn't do it with the scope of the project, I'm sure.
James, you've been quiet so far. I guess one question I have for you is what's your level of excitement for WarioWare DIY? Because that's coming out pretty soon.
Well, if I had a DSi, it'd be a lot higher.
You don't need a DSi to play it.
It's a retail game.
Oh, that's right.
The only thing is it's got a WiiWare like companion thing.
Yes,
where you can like play games made on people's DSs on a WiiWare app. But yeah, DSiWare isn't involved at all.
I'm moderately excited for that game because I'm probably care more about that franchise than anybody else here, but I'm just not good at that kind of creative thing in games. It's not really my forte.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that it's the kind of game for me.
I guess the one thing is it just seems a lot more doable than, like, say, making a really great Little Big Planet level. I mean, obviously people have made really great Little Big Planet levels. I've played some of them online, but, like, for the average punter, you know, making a few, like, mainly the idea of them is to be funny micro games just seems a lot more possible.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even if it's easy to make them, there's a certain amount of creativity that goes into those games that make them interesting.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, sometimes you just don't feel like it's worth the effort, or you can kind of leech off other people's efforts.
Well, yeah. The more I hear about the WiiWare channel, which I guess is, they haven't said how much it'll cost, but I'm sure it'll be $5 or $10. But the more I hear about that, the more I think that might be the route for me, and maybe for you too, James, because that's kind of the leecher's option. Because you can sort of play other people's micro games without really having to worry about having the tools to make your own. Because, yeah, I'm the same way. Like, I don't think I would really spend all that much time making my own. But I would like kind of like to play other people's. And it's going to be cheaper to do it on WiiWare.
I'm just curious how that's going to work, though. If you make a game on the DS, how does that convert to the Wii? I mean, because
it's in operation in Japan because they've had this for ages. I mean,
yeah, I know. I'm just curious if how cleanly it converts if you design the game to be played on the DS to the Wii.
I think there's certain restrictions that they've got, you know, like in terms of how you could use the touchscreen functionality and things like that. It's all carefully framed to ensure that the compatibility, I think.
Well, I guess the final thing I'd mention is that March sounds like it's going to be really good for WiiWare because we're finally getting Cave Story. And a couple other things as well, including some new art style games for WiiWare, not DSiWare, for WiiWare. It's finally coming back.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time since we got art style on WiiWare, and the two new ones that they've shown are pretty nice looking.
Well, Light Tracks is .stream from the Bit Generations again, so it's like
I didn't like the portable version of that one, but Rotozoa actually looks a lot more interesting to me.
Yeah, well, I guess one of the cool things with this new version of .stream is that you've got different camera angles and stuff, so rather than just being purely side on. So it definitely looks trippier. I mean, I don't know. I remember Steven Rodriguez played it and did an absolutely brilliant episode of this podcast on it called Talking About My Bit Generations. And listened back to it to discover whether I was being sarcastic. Quite liked it, and I quite liked it too. I mean, it's got like a really sort of reduced form, a discrete version of the F-Zero boost system in terms of like your boosts are your lives in essence. If you crash into something, you lose a life, which is also a boost.
That sounds like a really bad Vin Diesel movie. Your boosts are your lives.
Your NOS is your
blood.
You crash
into things, you lose your lives, and you lose your boosts.
I live from race
there's
to race.
There's a lot of drafting, too, in terms of, you know, kind of getting behind.
If you can go right alongside another stream, then you kind of gain speed.
I actually played Wendy's copy of it, and it didn't click for me. But it is very cool looking on Wii, anyway.
Yeah.
So it's probably time to drop the summit talk. I believe there is a considerable amount of discussion about that on the newscast, so you might want to check that out for more discussion about everything that happened. I'm sure they'll be a lot more exhaustive than we were. In any case, it's time for new business, and you know, since John wasn't here last week, I'd like him to start off.
I will start off, Johnny.
Actually, let me ask you, John, if you can start with a segue from last episode since you weren't here. Mm-hmm. Can you catch us up with some thoughts on Super Mario RPG? I mean, you don't have to go in detail, but I just kind of would, you know, we haven't really heard from you on it.
Oh, Super Mario RPG, you know, I had some really, really elegant things to say about it, and they've just completely fallen right out of my head in the past week.
Isn't that always the way?
But yeah, I mean, like, my kind of thoughts on it are definitely the visual style of it. I don't feel, I'm sure you guys have gone over this, but I don't feel that the visual style is as impressive now as it was when it first came out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, at first I felt like it was kind of slow, but you know, it's the thing is, what I really liked, to me, it was kind of like one of the last games where it was kind of like the golden era of Mario. You know, because I've said before on the podcast that I feel sort of like as soon as Mario kind of went to 3D, he lost kind of some of almost that. He had kind of like a comic book character charm prior to going into 3D, and once he went into 3D, it was almost like he kind of became so packaged, and I don't know, there's just something about it. I mean,
it's about the voice. I mean, you know, kind of, one of the last times he didn't have the vocalizations of Charles Martin.
Yeah, and maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe them trying to kind of almost give him a sort of personality. But I felt like in Super Mario RPG, I felt like one of the things I love about it so much is the fact that it makes fun of the Mario series itself. You know, it's sort of, everything is kind of done with like, kind of like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge sort of roll of the eyes. Like, oh, the princess got kidnapped again. Oh, what a surprise kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, there are certain things that you can make fun of in the Mario series. I think this was one of the first places where it really was done. And that's one of the reasons why I like it so much. Mm-hmm. In terms of battle, I really love like the battles, how it's so easy to just pick everything up. What I thought it was really effective at was the fact that even though you have kind of a truncated list of armor, quote unquote, you can actually really, like, you know, do quite a bit. I guess it's shortened in ways, but it doesn't feel like it's dumbed down at all. Like,
right.
Which is really kind of like a very fine line to walk if you're square soft.
Yeah, and Paper Mario does feel dumbed down to me in some respects. I mean, I still like the game, but there, you know, when it comes to like, you know, the armor and the weapons and stuff like that, sometimes it can feel that way. It's just like so reduced. It's so simplified. Mm-hmm. And Mario RPG, there's a good bit of Final Fantasy in it. You know, you can still feel that. So it's kind of a nice balance between the two extremes.
Yeah. One of the things that I didn't like about it was it seems like there's kind of like gateway things where if you don't have a certain item, you will absolutely get your ass kicked. But as soon as you get it, you're just wiping the floor with everything you come up against. Like, I know that once you get the hammer, you're just dropping everything.
Yeah.
Well, it fluctuates, doesn't it?
Well, it just seems like John, it's really obvious, though. Point here. I mean, even later in the game, I kept playing beyond our retroactive discussion last week, and because I like the game, and I wanted to kind of see some parts that I hadn't seen since the late 90s. And I played through the sunken ship, the Jonathan Jones shark boss that we talked about a little bit last time. And I was really having a lot of trouble in that ship. I mean, the enemies were just rocking my world. And I posted something about it in the forums, and some people gave me some advice, which helped a little bit. But the main thing was I just basically played until I gained a level for everybody. And then all of a sudden, it was just piss easy.
It was a tipping point, was it? Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it was just went from incredibly difficult to really, really easy in one level up.
Yep.
Wow. It's not something that I experienced. I mean, I think I was quite underleveled, but I made rigorous use of, was it Mallow's lightning or thunderbolt, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That is immensely useful in mm-hmm. that.
It is a very powerful attack, yeah.
Especially you get the timing right on the last press. You get that right, you are golden.
Yeah. It does a lot of damage and it's really cheap. So, yeah, there are definitely a few special attacks you can abuse.
I don't know whether maybe they set it up in such a way that they were kind of like, well, you know, if they get to a certain level, then it's kind of should be easy for them. Let's just let them get through this now, you know, kind of yeah. a more deliberate kind of a version of what is done in something like Dragon Quest.
I was just thinking that I just think the game is just poorly balanced. I don't think it was a deliberate act on their part for the game to just surrender.
It's just rare for such a tipping point in one level.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it might also be a product of them having a smaller range of armor, for example. So
it's not as intricate, the systems.
Yeah, there wouldn't be as much of a grading. Like it would be like kind of like a stair step instead of a gradual curve.
Anyway, so John, what newer games did you play in the past couple
well,
weeks?
Well, I finally hooked up the Japanese Wii that Wendy sent me a while back. And of course, you know, the first thing I grabbed was Disaster Day of Crisis.
Damn what?
The legendary Disaster Day of Crisis. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to get back to it. I put about probably about an hour and a half into it. But definitely enough to get the flavor of Day of Crisis.
So how do you get the flavor out of your mouth? That's a better question.
Yeah, it was interesting. My impression of probably about the first hour of the game is really long cutscene, quick time event. Really long cutscene, quick time event. Really long cutscene, quick time event.
It's like Heavy Rain.
the two sort of coexist somewhat in Heavy Rain. I played the first 2 hours and a half to 3 hours of this when I got to play it before it came out in Europe. So I've experienced this as well much longer ago. But it really, when you get a bit further, mm-hmm. the pacing kind of picks up a bit, and that's where you start to get more of the time crisis stuff, basically. The real meat of the game is the time crisis stuff.
Yeah, meat being the opportune word.
Bear meat.
Yeah, I've gotten right to the point where he's... the whole thing is, I was laughing all the way through, because this thing is like... It's like a buddy cop movie... It's like buddy cop movie cliche after buddy cop movie cliche. Except there's only one guy.
He drops his buddy in the lava, like, straight away.
Of course, I know. But of course, you know, it's like no!
Oh, yeah,
and Steve falls slowly down into the lava. Not that I want to spoil it for anybody.
Wait,
because it's...
why is there lava?
Oh.
Because it's disaster.
Because it's some sort of tectonic voodoo that's going on.
At the start of the game, apparently there is a volcano erupting somewhere, and they're a rescue team, and they're rescuing people from this. You know,
they didn't do a very good job, did they?
Yeah, the volcano's in the background, and you know, it's kind of like it's the classic thing where they're like, okay, we're all done, let's head for home, and then.
Would you say this is more like Tommy Lee Jones' Volcano or Pierce Brosnan's Dante?
I think it's more in the volcano part, in the sense that.
Okay. Because Volcano is definitely the more ludicrous.
Well,
of
I haven't
the two.
Seen either one of those movies, and I don't think I ever
saw
will
both have. Of them in the theater.
Volcano was about a volcano emerging in LA.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That sort of science fiction part of it definitely fits better with Disaster.
I guess so.
Absolutely.
I like that in an effort to rescue people, he just drops his buddy in a volcano. It's a nice job.
he didn't mean to drop him, but you know.
No.
Nice work.
Actually,
by
his buddy
you.
actually says, "Just let me go. You can't save everybody, Ray." And then it's like, oh, you know, I'm sitting seriously.
He's still dealing with some deep stuff, right?
It was
Ray's
touching.
Got a messiah complex. You
he
know?
Really does. Ray looks like he's a very hairy, hairy guy. He's just like his hair. He's like all beard and like spiky hair. You know, I'm like, dude, get a Gillette. Just do something with that.
Well, you would say that, wouldn't you, John?
True. I guess
it's all relative.
Yeah. True. I can't deny that for sure. I'm like, you know, you'd look good with a shaved head.
So, John, I don't want you to blow your disaster load here because you've got more to play.
Yeah,
so.
You've got to get past the bits that I got to, at least. You have to tell me more of what comes.
So where I'm at right now is, right, it's at the first kind of, like, you know, gunplay sort of thing where you come up to a warehouse. Of course, classic thing right at the start, The guy's like, yeah, you know, I'm really sort of like the chief, police chief, rescue chief, whatever chief he is. He says, you know,
chief of chiefs.
He says, yeah, I'm really sorry that your partner died, blah, 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 kind of thing. And then something happens. I forget exactly what, but Ray is like, I have to go and do something. And then his chief is like, no, you can't. And it has the whole kind of like, you're a loose cannon, Bryce. You know, that's the thing. He's like, no, you're not going to stop me, chief. This is my this is my battle to fight. Yeah, that kind of whole thing. And then, of course, he gets to the warehouse. And this is where I turned it off, partly because I had to go to sleep, partly out of disgust.
Partly because your brain can only take so much sodomy before you just give it.
I couldn't handle it anymore. But he's sitting there. He rolls up. There's like some sort of like deal going on between the bad guys. They've taken over some warehouse or something. And so he decides to take it upon himself to take out the bad guys.
But he's not a loose cannon. Let's keep it clear. He is not a loose cannon. Well, he's just going to go take out all these bad guys.
The classic thing is he's talking to his chief on his walkie-talkie. And his chief is like, you know, don't go in there, don't go in there. And he's like, his chief is like, you're only one man. What are you going to do? And he says something like, well, I guess you're just going to have to take notes. Or he says something like that, and that's the end of the cutscene. And I'm like, Dave Crisis, I love you. You're ridiculous.
Do you remember the bit of The Simpsons where they've got McBain and you got the chief that's like, here we do things by the book, and he just holds up the book, and then McBain shoots it and says, by book. They should just make it like that. It would have been better. They should have just gone the whole log.
It's exactly like that. I mean, it's just like McBain. It's awesome.
It is great.
Awesomely bad.
But I think what it is that it's the whole subplot is like the guy he dropped in the lava's sister is involved in that shootout.
Yeah, that's right.
the lava's sister.
Yep. Yeah. Don't spoil it, though, Greg. Don't spoil it.
No,
you've already had the climactic bear fighting.
Yeah.
Oh, is that already over? No.
I'm just saying he's already had it spoiled for him by you, James. You already gave away the ending.
That's not fair because the images they showed right away had a bear fight. It's like, wow, this is my kind of game.
I can't wait to play Xenoblade when it says from the creators of Disaster Day of Crisis.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about that.
It's funny how they changed it from Monado to Xenoblade, not Disaster Blade or something.
Crisis Blade.
That actually does sound like an RPG, Crisis.
Yeah,
it's the new trend in Nintendo assisted or Nintendo published games where they take a title and actually make it worse.
Mm-hmm. I think the thing that cracks me up the most, though, is the thought that apparently they did actually re-record some stuff or tune it a bit for the West, what would have been the Western release before killing it in America, and then of course it did come out in Europe. But they went to some effort not to just like shit the Japanese approved dialogue into the Western market, and then thought, no, it can't be salvaged, forget it, give
it's
up.
Just
no.
Too bad.
They had to tell the localizer, you can't save everything.
You can't.
You're only one man.
So did Treehouse do the localization of that game?
Who knows?
I just have to imagine there was a point where someone's like, oh, I can't fix this. I don't want to.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out why they didn't release it in the US, because it's not a horrible game. I mean, there are many, many worse games for the Wii.
I think the on-rail stuff is kind of fun. Yeah. I played a bit. But I mean, guess the thing is, like, if it was coming out now, it'd be just really old hat because there's been quite a lot of better on-rail stuff since, you know. And the thing is that I think, I don't know, everyone who's reviewed the game shares this opinion, but at least of what I played, the other stuff is horrible. I remember telling on the show talking about this bit where you just run back and forth in this burning park, waggling to put yourself out.
Terrible. Well, that's one of the things they do right at the start. It's just gratuitous waggle. Like you have to walk through a wall of fire, and of course you catch on fire. You have to sit there and waggle.
Fire does that.
To put it out.
I know you're playing this in 2010, but that had to come out in 2006.
Yeah,
to not be offensive.
Yep.
That's amazing.
But yeah, I mean, I was just thinking that, I mean, for that to have come out when it did, I don't think that it really showed off what Nintendo wanted to show off for the console. That's probably why it didn't come out over here. It's kind of old school. And old school, I mean, 2000 or 1997, maybe. this is kind of like the first Resident Evil. That's what it reminds me of.
Nice.
Kind of awkward gameplay, terrible voice acting, ridiculous cutscenes. It's pretty much the Wii equivalent of that.
But is it as ridiculous as? Because I mean, I don't think there's anything like Jeeble Sandwich in there.
Yeah, the first Resident Evil was ridiculous, terrible.
Like
the opposite of scary.
Yeah. Like disaster. Yeah. I feel like they had to know that this game, like when they were writing it, they had to be like, all right, guys, I got an idea. What? A bear.
Well,
it's
a very particular look at, you know, this outsider's perspective of what American action movies are.
Exactly. Yes. I was thinking the same thing.
So how do they make them gritty? Well, I would say the word shit a lot. It's really much. It's like, if you know the way that Jack Bauer says "damn it" to avoid saying the word shit. Well, mm-hmm. It's kind of like if you just replace that around so that he just says shit all the time.
Well, what I kept thinking of was if you've seen Rush Hour with Chris Tucker.
Oh, you know,
there's a scene at the start of the movie where they're in the maybe it's Rush Hour 2 where they're in the karaoke bar.
That's Rush Hour 2.
Is it Rush Hour 2? Yeah, where they're singing like Elvis or country or something like that. And I thought that is exactly what that game is. It's like it's the kind of the Japanese view of Western action movies.
The funhouse mirror, basically.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, even though, like, yes, they are often bullshit, but this is like a slightly different brand of bullshit.
Yep.
This is a whole nother level.
Well, John, I have to ask you, we don't often get to talk about games before they're actually out.
Mm-hmm.
And you did play one this past week.
Yeah, Aaron was fortunate enough to, at the Media Summit, he talked to some of the Capcom PR people, and apparently they were handing out WiiWare codes for Mega Man 10. And by the time he got to me, they were out of that, but I did get it for the PS3.
Sure, yeah. You didn't specifically request it for PS3.
Oh, heck no. Oh, heck no. I am not.
We know your agenda.
Sorry,
because
the Wii's
not a PS3
Even though I have more trophies than John.
See, there you go. See, come on. I mean,
well, because
you know,
he just buys the games to look at them. I mean, that's...
See, here we go.
Right.
You can't get trophies by having it on your shelf.
No.
John has physical trophies.
The way I look at it is this. A lot of the trophies on John's list have got like 0%, 3%, or whatever. But, you know, those are the ones he's put in the drive. So, I mean, it's a tiny slice.
That's
like,
so,
it's a comedy routine, I tell you.
So,
every time.
Mega Man 10, dude. I'm excited for Mega Man 10.
Yeah, it's...
Sheep Man.
Sheep Man.
I've been having dreams of Sheep Man.
Do Mega Men dream of electric sheep?
Well, there's no female robot this time around, so...
No, you can play as Proto Man, though.
So you get sunglasses and a bad attitude. Awesome.
Have you tried the easy mode yet?
No.
Because they changed the level design for that.
Yeah, I've not tried the easy mode. The normal mode is a bitch.
I saw, like, a video where it's just showed the difference, like, and it's like there's some parts that would have had, like, spikes on or whatever, like, paved over. You know, so they actually... It's not just, like, a damage health kind of thing.
Well, Greg, I mean, I'm never going to sink to the depths of trying easy mode on any game. I mean, it's just,
you just won't play it.
It's just not how I roll. But I have not tried the easy mode. Proto Man, though, I mean, he's I'm trying to determine whether or not Proto Man is stronger. It feels like he has stronger attacks, but he is weaker in terms of what enemies can do to him, right? Like, I think he's that's still kind of the way he seems, and he has, you have the secondary attacks. Proto Man has two as opposed to Mega Man's one. I mean, Mega Man, he can call in this dog. Is it Coil or something? I don't know. I'm not a Mega Man fiend, but...
Rush Coil.
Rush, yes.
Yeah, he is. So that's what but Proto Man can bring in the equivalent of Coil, which is just kind of like this mechanical trampoline, like a little...
Perfect.
Yeah. And
and Proto Man can slide, right?
I haven't done that. I don't think... See,
that's
I've tried...
That's what I heard.
Yeah, I haven't been able to do that. Pearl Man, I mean, his other thing is he has the kind of jet platform that he can spring and hop on. And
does anybody else like the fact that he's Proto Man, yet he's clearly more advanced than his successor?
Yeah, well,
successor?
I guess they shot higher the first time, but then the bugs were glitches, and so they had to scale down the ambition for the finished
product.
All right,
so the first one turned evil. Let's not do that this time.
Yeah, because Proto Man is like number 001, right? And Mega Man is 002.
Yeah, that's why he's Proto Man.
Proto Man also has a shield, too, that you can block attacks with.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
you
he's
say,
pretty much
it.
Better in every single way than Mega Man.
What about the... have you got any of the weapons yet?
No, man, I haven't even... I haven't beaten any of the bosses yet. I've tried. I made sure I went through and I tried every stage. And most of the time, because I mean, you get to the kind of mini, like the mid level mini boss, and I've been able to beat a couple of them. Most of them are pretty tough. But yeah, there's Blade Man, Solar Man, Sheet Man, Chill Man, Nitro Man,
Chill Man,
Strike Man, Pump Man, and Commando Man.
Commando Man.
Yeah, Commando
Man. Yes,
Bennett.
Get in the chopper.
Well, I mean,
that's Predator, John.
Is it Predator? Jesus. Ah, you see, that's what I have you here. I have you here to school me on the.
Yeah, I keep him honest.
The terrible Schwarzenegger.
Greg is such an expert on 80s movies.
I know.
It's amazing that they only spent 6 years alive during the 80s, and I can remember two of them.
That's right, John. John remembers the whole thing.
Yeah,
the whole sword in the fair. Well, sort of, as much as the dementia allows.
Yeah.
Well, I do think that in the reality of the situation is, John, once you crack that first boss, you'll probably be in better shape, because that's kind of how a lot of those older Mega Mans were. It's getting that first foot in the door, and then you can kind of just work your way through the progression.
I think it was, what's his name? Exactly the space guy in Mega Man 9. He's Galaxy Man.
Yeah.
Who's awfully ambitious title, by the way.
Yeah. That was when that first inroad, I was like, I hadn't played a Mega Man game before, and I was like, God, I mean, this is pretty depressing. Or something.
It really
can't
is.
Be anything. And then once the first domino fell, it started to get, you know, to come into focus. And it's that's what's really cool, like picking your battles, like what one you think you can take.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
No, I mean, John, you're doing it the right way in that you tried all the levels, because the trick is always to basically try them all, find the weak point, you know, find the chink in the armor where you can actually get a foothold. And like James is saying, once you beat the first one or two, you're golden, because then it's just a matter of figuring out, you know, using the weapons that you've gained to give you an advantage, and you start to collect energy tanks and things like that.
Yeah, that's not the case in some of the, like Mega Man X 4, I think, where not everybody gives you a useful fucking power. Mm-hmm. Awesome. It's like, oh, good.
They realize.
Perfect.
They've been too generous.
And then there's also Mega Man 2, where you can get the metal blade and then just beat everyone.
Excuse me, I would like to break your game. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Metal Man is not necessarily the easiest boss to start with, but he's definitely the one you should start on.
Just keep
because
going.
His weapon kills everything.
I think Mega Man 2 was the first Mega Man game I played at 4. And I think even I figured that shit out.
Is it Mega? I think it's actually in Mega Man 2 when you get to the boss rush up right before Dr. Wily. You can actually kill Metal Man with his own weapon in one hit.
That's ridiculous. That's just
like, not only is it the best weapon in the game, it kills the, you know, the reverse is when you fight the boss again and use his own weapon against him, it kills him in one hit.
That's awful. Yeah, hopefully
what
there's
happened?
None of that in this
How
one.
Did this happen?
So far I think Pump Man's level is so far the easiest.
Pump Man,
it's kind of like a like sewer themed, like you're kind of like underground with all this.
Not Austin Powers themed. Yeah.
Well, there's
no,
also
but when you beat him, you get these awesome basketball shoes. They help you jump higher. And they make your friends jealous.
The best feeling about these games is when you finally get to the boss and you're like, all right, you're kind of like watching your health versus his. Okay, I'm down to about 3/4. He's to about half. I'm in good shape. And then something horrible happens and you're wiped out in about 8 seconds.
The fortunate thing is they usually do let you kind of give you like a little farming area before a boss. Like,
that's nice.
There's a couple of enemies I know in the one level, I think it was Sheep Man, where right before one of the mini bosses, there's these enemies that split, and so you can sit there and like allow them to, you know, go like 1 to 2, 2 to 4, and then you can shoot them all, and then you can pick up the health.
Okay, so I'm gonna talk about No More Heroes 2. I did actually play it this week. Finally, I played it, and I like it. It's No More Heroes, but again,
so more heroes.
It's more No More Heroes. They should just call it More Heroes too. But it's the action feels exactly the same. The structure of the game is definitely a little bit different. You know, there's no more riding around on your motorcycle because you just select from a menu where you want to go. And the other big thing is, I would say, you don't have to earn money to enter the ranking battles. there's no entrance fee, so you just, when you're ready to move on with the story, you just select that in the menu and you play that. So the side job, it's ironic, but actually, because the side jobs are so much better in the sequel. You know, there are all these 8-bit retro games, and they're actually surprisingly fun. There are definitely a couple that feel like mini games. I mean, there's one where you're cooking steaks for people, and it's just a matter of holding the button down until it's cooked to the right color, and then you let go. I mean, that's like something you'd get in a Kirby game. You know, it's really, really ultra simple. It's almost like a WarioWare game. But then there are others. I mean, the Coconut Grabber game is my favorite so far, and this was terrible in the first one.
Right.
You're bumping into, you're like headbutting trees and then getting
knocked on the... admittedly was funny for all of 10 seconds.
It was funny, but it wasn't actually good. It wasn't actually
yeah,
fun.
It was fun for 0 seconds.
Right. And in the sequel, in Desperate Struggle, you know, they've turned it into this side-scrolling 8-bit game that feels kind of like Adventure Island or something. And it actually is definitely the deepest, and it's the mini game that, or it's the job that requires the most skill so far I've seen. Because you pass by these trees and you kick them, and the coconut will fall off at some angle, and then you'll have to dash and run over to get it and try to catch it in midair. Because once it hits the ground, it's very, very difficult to catch it on the second bounce. And if it hits you, you have this basket on your back that you have to catch it in. But if it hits you on your head, you'll be stunned. So there's a very fine line between getting knocked on the head by the coconut and actually successfully collecting it. And it takes a lot of skill. And, I mean, playing through 3 or 4 levels, you kind of start to pick up the skills involved in actually doing this well, doing it on the fly. There's a time limit. The stages get longer. So you really kind of get to the point where you want to just run through them full blast and catch coconuts as you go rather than stop and get them slowly and take your time. And there are enemies that are blocking your way, and they're positioned in very clever ways so that it makes it difficult to catch coconuts because there are enemies there. It's like shockingly well done and really surprisingly fun. And again, the funny thing is that you don't actually really need to play the side jobs in this game. They're almost entirely optional because you don't really need any money to play the game. So you can earn money to train at the gym or to try to buy new weapons, which again they're not really all that necessary. But yeah, the side jobs they're mostly just there for fun, and they are fun. They're really good.
No, I mean that's the thing. I mean the last game, the padding, the sort of deliberately bad, deliberately menial tasks.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
I really struggle with that. I did want to keep going. I did keep going. I finished it, but
yeah.
That made it really tough at times to engage with the game, and so.
Well, you'll like this one more.
Even though it's kind of perverse that they're like a lot better but optional, I'm still very happy about
yeah.
that.
No, I mean it's weird because I mean it has all these little retro things, and it does end up feeling a little bit like Retro Game Challenge, and just yeah, there's just this smorgasbord of weird retro things. I mean, the games generally aren't as deep or as interesting as the ones in Retro Game Challenge, but
they aren't the core of the game either.
They're well done. The music is really good. The battles, I will say, I guess I've done 3 rank battles so far, so I'm still early in the game. But they do a nice job of kind of keeping them varied. And that was one of the best things about the first game is that, you know, you might get sick of beating up on these idiot pizza delivery dudes or whatever. And there is still some of that repetition in terms of just, you know, fighting the standard enemies. I don't know. So far, I'm finding that Desperate Struggle is actually kind of easy. It seems like they've toned it down a little bit from the first one. And yesterday, I started trying to play it with Classic Controller because they added that for the sequel.
Right.
And I kind of thought it would be kind of a throwaway thing and it wouldn't really feel like No More Heroes without the motion controls. But I mean, maybe this is blasphemous, but I actually like it a lot more with the Classic Controller. And I think it's just a little more relaxing to play. It doesn't take quite as much effort. It feels like the game plays a lot faster when you're using the Classic Controller. And I found that the combat was kind of easier, which just makes you wonder, like, obviously the game is balanced for motion control because you can't do the attacks quite as quickly, I guess. and you have to think a little more about, you know, whether your, you know, whether your beam soars up or down or whatever. But
yeah,
with a classic controller, it plays extremely well and very, very fast, and it just, the whole game feels a lot smoother and easier.
It sounds like the complete opposite of Sinner Punishment 2.
Oh, really?
Because they included classic controller support, but it's like, oh, I can't handle it. I can't, you know, it's overwhelming trying to do it with the old school style.
Yeah, it will be the equivalent of probably doing like mouse cursor control with the analog stick, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Ah, brutal. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it actually makes me think that when they end up porting, I don't know if it's going to be the first or the second one or some combination of the two, when they end up porting that to Xbox and PlayStation 3, I think it's actually going to work out surprisingly well. I don't know if it'll be a financial success for Ubisoft or whoever publishes it, but I do think people who tried No More Heroes on the other systems will find that, oh, wow, this is actually a pretty fun game.
Yeah. It's a weird one because it's only confirmed to be coming out in Japan so far, I think. Huh. But the original No More Heroes just totally bombed in Japan.
Oh, yeah, it was an absolute travesty.
Megaton disaster.
There were like Spinal Tap moments of Suda 51 in some game store handing out toilet paper that nobody wanted.
Whereas it did perform somewhat respectably, obviously, elsewhere. I don't think they would have been able to make a sequel.
It did quite well in the US.
Yeah, I don't think it did badly in Europe either, so it's kind of strange that regard.
But anyway, the Desperate Struggle is a lot of fun. It's very, very much like the first one. And, you know, again, in terms of the main action, it's not that much different. But the second, maybe technically the third ranking battle that I played was one of these nice moments. You remember in the first game where you had the battle on the motorcycle and it's like, oh, this is kind of a nice change of pace.
Sure, yeah.
There's a moment like that pretty early in the sequel. It's not a fight on a motorcycle, but it's definitely not what you're expecting. And beyond that, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's actually really cool. And it's very, very different from, you know, what you normally do in the game. So it definitely still has the capacity to surprise you. And I do feel like most of the effort is put into these, you know, first of all, there's a lot of effort put into these mini games, the retro stuff, for sure. And then the boss battles, you know, they're very creative. They're the best balanced part of the game, for sure. They're actually somewhat challenging. The other stuff, you know, fighting random dudes at the university or whatever, not that great. I mean, it's okay. It's not boring necessarily, but it is repetitive. It's very simple. When you actually get into a boss fight, that's when the game gets good. So that's all I'll say about it, and Greg is up next.
Yep. First of all, I want to declare victory. I finally took down Sin and Punishment 2 on hard this past week.
Nice.
Finally, that's been a long time in the pipeline. It gets incredibly difficult towards the end. Rock solid. I mean, the hard mode in general is not that different. There are some changes to attack patterns in the latter bosses that are quite significant, but in the main, it's a damage kind of health thing. But sometimes it does make it so much more difficult. You can get hurt so much fewer times before you die that you do have to take quite radically different approaches to how you're going to kill these things, because you've got to kill them a lot quicker, essentially, because it could be phenomenal at dodging, but you're going to take a certain amount of hits with all the crap that's going on. So you do get a sort of different perspective on it, even though it's not the most substantive different hard mode that Treasure's ever done, certainly.
Well, congratulations, and that's now a nice tease for us Americans, and the Europeans too, I guess.
And really, a gauntlet being thrown down, if you will.
No, not really, because nobody else has that kind of masochism.
You don't get anything for hard, but you get something cool for doing it on any difficulty with both characters. I will say, I won't spoil what it is, but I think it's kind of neat, a little unlockable. So that's worth pursuing. But yeah, it's brilliant. I love it. I mean, you know, like I said, there's some pacing issues and stuff, but overall, I mean, this is, you know, an intense action game that you cannot get on another console. It could not be this crazy, this, you know, intense on another console.
But Greg, you don't feel as strongly about the sequel as you do the first game, do you?
I think the first game was just more of a revelation for me. I mean, this is very much delivering on the concept of the first game, choosing between them or whatever. There's no doubt which made more of an impact on me, but this is, you know, in many ways, it's like seeing it kind of fully realised, although there's some, you know, it kind of takes some of that more platforming kind of element out of it and makes it a bit more of a traditional kind of shooter. But it's if you like, if you know, this thing is, it's a very particular sort of thing. So, you know, as good as it is in so many ways, you know, a lot of people are just not amenable to it, and that's, you know, that's the way it is. That's the kind of game that it is. But for what it is spectacular, and you aren't getting what this gives you anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, in terms of where Nintendo of America has slotted Sin and Punishment 2, I mean, it is between Mario and Metroid, but I feel like the people who are gonna get Sin and Punishment 2 are gonna get it regardless.
Yeah, probably.
And, I mean, it is a pretty niche game, and it seems like it's a minor game for NOA, and that's probably the right approach.
Of course it is. I mean, you should just, you know, I mean, really, it's just kind of, you know, especially because it really did very poorly in Japan. It's just surprising that it's surprising that it's being made, you know, on a commercial basis. I mean, in terms of the gameplay concept and the perfect marriage with the interface and stuff, it makes all the sense in the world. Commercially, it doesn't make very much sense at all. And then the sort of compound that by actually bringing it to America and Europe. I mean, I'm just surprised about Europe. Even, you know, because we've seen differences between America and Europe. You know, there was a time where I thought, well, America's biting, but well, Europe, but they are. So it's great for people that like it. There's just not that many of us.
Yeah, I mean, it seems more like a new school, old school arcade game is what it strikes me as.
It is, you know, the arcade sensibilities there, especially about the score tables and stuff, but it's just on this sort of relatively very massive scale.
Yeah.
For that. But obviously that doesn't make it like a, you know, a 15-hour game, or although, God, I don't know how much time I spent beating some of those last bosses. Heartbreaking, some of them. Heartbreaking losses.
I'll be interested to see how hard NOA really tries to sell it, because if they end up releasing it at a lower price point than normal, that tells me that they're actually trying to kind of expand the audience of it. Whereas if they release it at $50, they know they're only going to sell, you know, 70,000 copies, and they're okay with that.
I think where they're slating it for release tells you they don't expect it to
be a
major seller.
They're going to be, you know, launching with both barrels, you know, with these other two games.
In the middle.
It really needs a separate path of marketing, you know, that reaches different channels.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hardcore games that didn't sell that great.
Well, that's, Muramasa. I picked this up. It came out in Europe quite a lot later than it did in America, actually. It came out towards the end of November, I think. So it hasn't been out too long here. Although I kind of went back and forth on this for a long time. I remember considering importing it for my Japanese Wii when it came out in April of last year, I think it was. But, you know, with the language stuff and the impressions about what kind of game it was, it's just, it's not worth the import premium to me. And then initially kind of waffled on getting it in Europe because one of the people at Rising Star Games, the European publisher of it, mistakenly said that it didn't have 60Hz support on the podcast.
That's kind of a killer, for
that lady. That would just kill it, wouldn't it? That would just ruin.
That's kind of a big mistake to make, though.
It turns out it does have 60Hz support, so yeah, that was a big mistake. That nearly cost them a sale, frankly, because don't forget Rising Star are the people that gave us 50Hz Little King Story, so it was a credible threat, if you like, that they hadn't done
the right
thing.
Are they just like the X-Seed of Europe?
Well, they're very much into the Marvelous stuff, you know, like No More Heroes and Little King Story and Muramasa. I think Marvelous actually owned a stake in them at one point, and they've sold it since. But eventually it came to a point where, yes, it's 60Hz, yes, it's conveniently available, I'm willing to get it under these circumstances. And, I mean, having listened to what you said, Johnny, about it and everybody, it is what I expected it to be, which is, first of all, I mean, however much media you see of it, it is still very, very impressive in person. I mean,
Muramasa is gorgeous. There's
so gorgeous. The layers of parallax are so many at times. It's almost mesmerizing. I mean, some of the stuff they do. It's like when you go into sort of the built up kind of city and the castle part, you know, and the stuff they do with the sloping roofs and stuff like that. It is very, very impressive what they do. So stylish, and the detail and everything. It's wonderful. But, I mean, I guess it kind of has to be, because there's just so much just walking in a straight line in this game. I mean, that's the real problem with it. I mean, I think the core gameplay is you know, really quite sharp for a brawler. I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, Hatsworth on speed, because it's kind of like juggling and comboing and all that, but it's so much faster than Henry Hatsworth. Like, I was really surprised, like taken aback by how fast and how smooth it is. I know it's like my old 16-bit part of my brain just thinks, well, if they're detail sprites, the game's going to run like shit, obviously. You know? I couldn't imagine the game of this detail being really fast and smooth, but it is. And you know, that part of the gameplay is I find it, you know, it's relatively simple, but you've got this, all these different swords, which, yeah, they're not that different, but they have different, like, special moves and stuff so that you could use as, like, a strategic thing about swapping them out and things like that. You know, it's not really deep or anything, but it just, you know, injects enough of a interesting kind of dynamic element into it. And it controls nicely. I've been using the Pro for it. All of that's fine, but it comes in such small doses, and so much of the game is just walking in a straight line in a map that really has, you know, no level design to speak of, a trivial level design, you know, and you are just spending a lot of time doing very little. I mean, when you get to the bosses, they look wonderful. They're, you know, long, prolonged, challenging fights. If you put, depending on what mode you choose, I guess to some extent, but I chose the harder one. And yeah, they're putting up a fight, and I'm really enjoying those. They're what's keeping me going playing the game, kind of like the original No More Heroes. Really, it's that, you know, that is what I'm going for. But there's just so much filler in between. It's kind of surprising that anyone thought that you could kind of get away with this. It's really weird.
It's the odd thing is that it has this Metroid style map to it that is
it's horrible.
The game should not need that.
It really doesn't.
Because you can only go back and forth, really.
It really is just, you know, kind of this facade. It's a strange game. It's nobody way. I mean, honestly, the core gameplay is like that of a brawler, but, you know, a sophisticated one, actually. But then the way it's kind of paced is more like an RPG, which is just ridiculous.
Yes.
So it's really overblown for a brawler, but then severely underdesigned for an explorative action game.
Right,
so it's in this weird middle ground where it's definitely still entertaining. I'm enjoying it. It's giving me what I expected and what I wanted out of it. But it's not quite like anything I've seen before in terms of this sort of kind of quite casual dismissal of the idea of, you know, level design.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll keep playing it. I think what I almost certainly won't be doing is playing through it with the other character and all that kind of stuff.
I can't imagine.
I think that would really. I think if it's supposed to take 15 hours or whatever to play through it once, that will be enough.
Yeah, I the only thing about that game that really confused the hell out of me was how basically the game is two-dimensional. Well, I mean, it literally is, but the second dimension of height just goes way the hell up in most cases for no reason whatsoever.
For no reason, yeah. There is verticality, but you're just scavenging for, like, the occasional item.
It's like, okay, you've climbed Mount Everest. Now drop back down and go to the next stage.
So, James, do you own Muramasa?
I have. I played it at E3, and then I rented it, and it came out.
Okay.
I played it for about 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, that's about how long I played it before I sent it back.
Yeah, I probably played just a little bit more of it. And like I said, I'm at this point, I'm still willing to keep going with it. I don't know whether it'll get even more bogged down, and I'll bail, but I've still enjoyed it.
I just felt like it wasn't going anywhere, and I'd kind of done everything that I wanted to do with it.
Yeah. I basically concluded that I might pick it up when it's cheap again.
Yeah, I don't think it's really hit, like, very low prices in America, even though it's been out since September, so...
But, you know, it is a game worth seeing in person, in motion.
I completely agree with that. And I don't think it's done too badly in America, really.
I hope not.
I know Shane Bettenhausen was on Four Guys One Up saying that it had done quite well. Obviously, he's going to shade it a little bit.
Yeah.
But, it didn't sound like it was putting lipstick on a pig too much.
Yeah, I think that was one of Shane's first major moves, was kind of picking that game up.
Handing it out of the PAX panel.
Yeah, because XSEED was going to publish it, I think.
Yeah, they were signed up for it, totally.
Yeah, yeah. And then Shane kind of said, we might do that one.
Maybe, like, not true or anything, but the implication I got is that XSEED is a little upset about that.
They got chiseled out of it.
It seems like Ignition maybe had some kind of right of first refusal or something that they exercised pretty late in the process. And they did that again maybe not as late, but they did that again for Arkrise Fantasia, which was originally going to be published by Exeed. In fact, Exeed demoed it to John, or who was it, to James and I. Were you there, James?
No, I got cut out of the Exeed.
Oh, dude, I'm sorry. Yeah, whatever, at E3. Exeed actually demoed Arkrise Fantasia to us, and now it's published by a different company, Ignition.
Yeah.
Wah, wah.
Things don't seem to quite work right for Exeed a little bit.
Yeah.
They're kind of a fly-by-night operation in some ways.
I think they kind of are, but we'll see how Fragile Dreams does. That is very cool game. It's quite under the radar at this point. I don't even know exactly when
it comes
out.
It's been out in Japan forever, too, which is a weird thing. And I mean, it has an absolutely amazing reputation, but you'd think there'd be more hype because of it.
Right. Yeah, I think the reason that there isn't more hype is that the publisher is
Exeed. They don't have the material. They have so few employees that they cannot just find the time to hire someone to hype it.
We'll see. Anyway, James, what have you been playing? We're finally up to you. We're finally going to wrap up this segment.
So, I finished off Edgeworth Investigations.
You've completed it?
Yes. It's not very long, no.
So what about the court? We had this question last week about the court scenes.
The game does not prominently feature trials. Let's put it that way.
Even though you're a district attorney, basically.
Instead, all of the elements of the trial are intermixed in the investigation process.
Hmm.
So because he is the DA, he leads up the investigations. And since apparently the entire police force is incompetent,
right,
he essentially solves the investigations.
Well, he's also a right. genius, right? That's his whole shtick.
He's looking for the perfect evidence, and that's his driving force.
Hmm.
Usually, there is a person who is suspected of being the murderer, because they're all murders.
Mm-hmm.
And that person is so clearly not the murderer, because they're too incompetent to possibly ever be the murderer. But you have to break up that case, essentially, with whatever evidence you have. Then you get sent on to go pursue whatever lead comes out of you busting up the current operating theory of the police department.
Yeah.
And then some other crazy-ass theory comes up and you have to bust that. But what's interesting is there's now two types of evidence that you get from investigating. There's the physical evidence that you put in your case that you use in trials to object with. And then there's these things called ideas, I think is the term they use for them.
But they're like pieces of the logic puzzles?
Yes, they're called, the actual puzzles themselves are called logic.
Yeah.
Where, like, Edgeworth will observe that something doesn't quite make sense, and then he'll file that away. And then when you find something else doesn't quite make sense, and they go together, you can put them together, and he'll figure out what was really going on here. Which is always nice, because in the Phoenix Wright games, you'd have two things that don't make sense, and you'd be like, these clearly go together, but nobody's going to fucking acknowledge this. Like, you'd be like, the window's broken, but all the glass is on the inside. There's a pipe outside the window. These don't seem to go together. It's like, no, really.
So now you can finally connect the dots.
Yeah, essentially. And usually when you connect them, either that solves that investigation, and you'll get the investigation complete, or that generates a piece of evidence.
I guess my question is, do you feel like Miles Edgeworth is superficially different from Phoenix Wright, or is it fundamentally different from Phoenix Wright?
In some ways, the difference is superficial, but how they split it up. So for me, playing a Phoenix Wright game, the investigation part is okay, and that's kind of where you start to put theories together in your head as to what's really going on here. Because these games really do a pretty good job of obscuring the actual
yeah.
events that transpired in the murder.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really when the court happens that everything starts to come together.
Right, in Phoenix Wright.
And that's when, yeah, and that's when you start to think, oh my god, I can kind of put pieces together now. And usually you do that about 20 minutes before the game does, but, you know, you deal with the confines of the game. In this game, the fact that they put the testimony stuff in the investigation makes the investigations go faster. But in the end, you still only piece everything together at the end of the cases anyway, so it doesn't ruin that suspense. But I struggled with this game because, honestly, the characters aren't as good. I mean, Miles Edgeworth's goal was to be a foil, and he doesn't work well as a main character.
Yeah.
He's a foil to the complete and utter, just almost stupidity that is Phoenix Wright, because Phoenix's character is kind of stupid.
He's a bumbling idiot.
Yeah. Yeah.
He kind of gets by on the seat of his pants.
Yeah, and Edgeworth is super prepared, super proper, and super, you know, intelligent. That's his gig. His job is to play the foil. In this game, the only character that really, I mean, they have some cameos from other characters, but Edgeworth is really the only consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, there are other characters that show up in multiple cases, but he's the primary character, and he doesn't have a good foil, because to be a good foil for Edgeworth, you'd have to be Phoenix Wright, and they are making an active effort not to include him in this game.
Yeah.
So is there an actual, or is there somebody that they're trying to make a foil?
He has an assistant, at least he does for some of the game.
You mean Gumshoe?
A Miss Moneypenny?
Gumshoe is in the game as his assistant for parts of the game, but he has another assistant. She's actually on the cover of the game. I won't go too much into her backstory. She kind of plays the role of a not-quite-so-stupid Maya.
Okay.
Which is Phoenix's assistant, but it's just not as funny. Their interactions aren't nearly as amusing, and they don't quite have the same character chemistry that those two do. So it's story-wise, it's probably not as good as the other games. Certainly, it might be on par with the fourth game. It's probably better than the second, which is just boring. But it's not nearly as good as the third or the first.
Are you saying it's better than Apollo Justice?
Yes.
High praise.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who's the big winner? Miles Edgeworth.
I would still say if you're a fan of the series, it's a good game, because the cases are actually pretty good, but the character interaction, which drives those games, isn't quite as strong.
But what you're really saying is wait for WiiWare?
No. I would say if you've played all the other games, and right now you're like, well, hell, go for it. But if you've not played them all, then go play one of the other Phoenix Wright games.
So if your choice is between punching yourself in the face and playing Miles Edgeworth, play Miles Edgeworth.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Okay.
If your choice... No question.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
If your choice is between playing... I mean, it's a good game. I'd give it like a 7 or so, but it's not as good as the highs of that franchise.
All right, so that's the end of new business, and now we're going to take a much-needed break, and when we come back, we'll have a little bit of commentary about the Games of the Decade poll results, and finally, we're going to catch up on your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
So this week, Aaron did a great job live blogging from the Nintendo Media Summit, and if you want a blow-by-blow account of the event, be sure to check it out. But of course, there's a whole lot of news that goes along with that. It's all associated, so you might want to check out the event profile for the Nintendo Media Summit Q1. In media, we also have tons of trailers and screenshots from titles like Super Mario Galaxy 2, Metroid Other M, Sin and Punishment 2, and Monster Hunter Tri.
Neil looks at a Tony Hawk ride, which he calls fun at times. However, John provided me with a really bad pun about the wheels falling off. Because...
I put that right in there, and I was laughing my ass off when I wrote that, James.
Zach also has a review of Dark Void Zero, which is a homage, as he puts it, 8-bit titles. However, it's short and also a promotional tool.
But perfectly executed and highly desirable.
Okay, continuing on this review train before it comes completely off the tracks. Neil gives us his take on Endless Ocean Blue World, which he considers superior to the original in pretty much every way. His one gripe is that, of course, you can't play MP3s during gameplay, so he can't play his Enya CDs.
He was he was pretending he was playing the first one.
Lord of the Rings soundtrack.
He says the sequel is more like a game this time around. It's kind of like a JRPG. And it's an absolute steal at $29.99 MSRP.
As far as I know, full price in Europe.
Oh, what?
Grant also, continuing the review debacle, Grant weighs in on the WiiWare title Shadowplay, which he says is a novel concept, which is solving puzzles by creating shadows on a wall. You have to kind of match them up to what's on the wall. It has great control, actually features Wii Motion Plus, I believe. Yeah. But unfortunately, it's a little bit too repetitive for his tastes.
Matt Blunden closes out the review cavalcade with his continuing DSiWare adventures. First of all, Cube Games Trajectile, which he says is a solid target-based shooting puzzle game, with the only drawback being its repetitive nature. He also takes a look at the Oregon Trail, a port of an iPhone version of the classic PC game. He appreciated the deep gameplay and cartoony look, which made it easier to handle the death of a family member.
I'm still waiting for the version of Oregon Trail when you're out shooting bears and deer and elk when one of your family members accidentally wanders out into the field.
Well, you know, you have to understand, when I played this game in school, I basically exterminated the North American grizzly.
Right. You can find all of that, read about it, read all about it on NintendoWorldReport.com. Okay, well, we're back, and to start off the second segment, our listener interaction segment here, I do want to follow up on the Game of the Decade poll. You might remember our short discussion on this a couple episodes ago. And, of course, immediately following the posting of that episode, we put the poll up and let everybody vote. Well, not everybody voted. It looks like everybody looked at it. But the poll has closed now, so I wanted to read off the results just so we get a little closure on this whole lengthy feature that we did. So according to Nintendo World Report readers and Radio Free Nintendo listeners, the game of the decade released on Nintendo platforms is Metroid Prime. Of 27.3% of the vote. And not a shock there, really. I mean, James, you groan a little bit, but are you surprised?
Disappointed.
Disappointed. Okay. And your choice out of the six would have been?
Any of the other ones.
Okay. So you're just not a big fan of Prime.
No.
I'm not a big fan of Metroid in general. I mean, you know, I could tell you from the deafening silence during the Super Metroid episode that is absolutely true.
There are plenty of totally legitimate criticisms of Metroid, and maybe we'll get into them eventually. I would kind of like to hear more from James on the topic sometime. But, I mean, you know, you can't deny Prime is an impressive game, and it seems to have a strong pull on a lot of people, including some of us present.
Sure. I'm still surprised, though. I'm still surprised it won overall. You know, I thought Smash Brothers would play bigger than it did.
Yeah. I think the most interesting thing about this poll is the second place winner. Again, Metroid Prime, not a big shock to me that that was the overall choice of the six games. I should note there was no other option here. So if you voted in the poll, you had to vote for one of the six that we chose.
Right.
And so I think actually probably a fair number of people looked at the choices and decided not to vote because, you know, either they couldn't decide between the two or three that they were, you know, most strongly considering, or else their favorite game just wasn't on the list. And we heard from some people who thought Wind Waker should be on there, etc. But to me, the biggest surprise is that number two in the voting, with 23.6% of the vote, that's just barely under the 27.3 of Metroid Prime, the second place vote attainer is The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask, which is a game that we waffled on a bit as to whether it should be included at all, mm-hmm. you know, versus Wind Waker.
And it nearly won. I was a little surprised.
It nearly won.
As you say, because it was late in the N64's life, and so if you wonder whether as many people had played it or whether you...
It is the oldest game in the poll.
If they went and played it on Virtual Console later, would it still have the same impact and stuff? But again, I mean, look, it's the pull of the Zelda franchise, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think, as we discussed on the show itself, there's so much to commend about it.
It's so unique. I think
for the people that did, you know, a bit divisive for a Zelda game because of the different structure and the time limits and whatnot, but I think for those that it did connect with, it did so powerfully. There's real affection for it, and I think that's why it did poll as well as it did.
Yeah.
Well, in third place, we had Super Smash Bros. Melee coming in at 15.5% of the vote.
Yeah, see, that's the surprising thing. It's not so much it would be third, but it's a distant third. I mean, Metroid Prime and Majora's Mask just dominated, really.
It is a distant third. And then very close behind it, tied actually for fourth place, Wii Sports and Super Mario Galaxy, both with 12.7% of the vote.
Yeah, I'd say Wii Sports was right where I thought it was. Galaxy, maybe I thought it would do a little better, but it's approximately in that kind of range that I'd expect.
Galaxy is the newest game on the list, so that could have something to do with it as well.
Well, I think the issue with Galaxy also is that many people don't feel like it didn't really make a new name for itself, essentially.
I don't think it's impactful as Metroid Prime, certainly. And then Majora's Mask was very unique as well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, I think there's some of that.
And then another really big surprise for me is Resident Evil 4 came in last place with only 8.2% of
it does make it look like the one non-Nintendo game got absolutely
It kind of reinforces the stereotype that Nintendo fans only buy Nintendo games.
But I think it was interesting because Voodoo, the moderator in the thread, did a little, you know, wanted to do a little experiment with people actually putting them in rank order. And what you tend to see there is that Resident Evil is a lot of people's second or third favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not enough people's number one, obviously. And I think that's the thing. You know, I think the thing with Wii Sports, it seems to be that it was very polarizing, you know, probably because people were voting for it on the impact factor.
Right.
You know, there were people that were voting for it to win, pretty, you know, respectable portion of it. And then perhaps everyone else would have put it sixth and not even considered it. And so Resident Evil is finishing behind Wii Sports. But, you know, I think its popularity is perhaps have been somewhat understated by that.
Yeah, interesting results. And I want to give a personal thanks to everyone who voted in the poll and everyone who posted in the thread. We had some really interesting discussion there, and it's ongoing. So if you have any thoughts on the results of the poll, you can find the thread in the Nintendo World Report forums, and I hope you'll leave your thoughts there. You know, it will continue in perpetuity. So now it's time to go on to listener mail. It's been a couple weeks since we really dug into listener mail, and I'm excited to, I really am excited to jump back into this. We've had a lot of great emails lately, including the first couple here, which are primarily what I would classify as yay us emails, to quote Film Spotting, one of my favorite podcasts. It's kind of the yay us portion of the show, but they're so nice and they're very eloquent, and so I wanted to throw them out there, and I think John has the first email.
All right. Chris from Chicago writes, "Hi, guys. I love the show. Recently, I was impressed by Greg's Game of the Decade piece about Metroid Zero Mission. I found his exposition on this handheld gem to be well thought out, expertly expressed, and very interesting. After listening to the piece, which felt more professional in quality than anything I have read or heard from IGN or 1UP, I remembered that you guys don't get paid for your efforts on NWR. I was hoping that you could each take a few moments and discuss what, if any, are your future plans or dreams in respect to the gaming industry. Do you hope to be a member of the gaming press in the future? Do you have aspirations to develop games? It seems to me that your experience creating the great content of this site would parlay directly into a career in this medium. Thanks, and keep up the great work."
Yeah, thank you very much for the nice letter, Chris. Yeah,
indeed, very, very complimentary. I'm glad I was able to do the game justice in someone's eyes, at least.
Yes, we appreciate that. As far as the question of our plans for the industry or our aspirations, it's something that I don't think we talk about that often on the show. It's something that, and I'm probably not the only one here on the show, it's something that my personal acquaintances ask me very often. Including my family members, like my mom and dad used to ask me this all the time, and it took me a long time to convince them that I wasn't looking to gaming as a career. The way I've characterized it for a very long time now, I mean, I've been doing this stuff, writing and podcasting, going all the way back to 1999 when I was still in high school. So the way I've always characterized it is as a hobby that I took way too seriously. And that's the way I want to keep it for as long as it's practical to do so. As some people might know, I'm an engineer. I'm in graduate school. I have been for a very long time. And I'm planning to graduate by the end of this calendar year. But I've never really had any aspiration to work in the gaming industry in a professional way, and in fact I've turned down opportunities to do so, and it's just because I always felt like it was nice, it was very comfortable for me to keep it as a separate part of my life that I can enjoy without having to worry about the finances of it or the pressures and the stresses of depending on it. Mm-hmm. So that's how I come at it, is that it's something I really love doing, but it's like rock climbing. You know, I mean, you know, living in Colorado, I know tons of people who are way into hiking and rock climbing and skiing and camping and all these outdoor activities, but you never ask them, "Hey, have you ever thought about doing that professionally?" No, I mean, it's something that they do to to relieve their daily stresses.
Yeah, it's a diversion.
The realities of normal life.
I think it's a little bit different, though, because the hobby itself is the actual gaming. The writing about it and pontificating on it weekly, that's a bit more of a stretch that the average person doesn't do.
We've taken it to a meta level, haven't we?
Yes.
A bit.
It is just, you know, I mean, you do it for the love of it, really. And for me, you're coming much later into it. It's not just for the love of Nintendo games, but it's for the love of this website, this podcast, which I listened to before. For what would it have been, about 18 months or something before I ever got on it. So that's how I came to it. I kind of felt, you know, this admiration and a willingness to try and maintain and uphold the standards of it, really. That's always been.
I think you've raised the standards to the point where it's not even recognizable
But I will absolutely cherish the memories of the old podcast the way it was. So they got, I mean, really, it got me into podcasts in general. It was the first podcast I ever listened to was this one.
Same.
Actually, before, you know, One Up Yours back then and all, you know, kind of opened my eyes to the whole thing. It started just listening to, you know, 20 minutes of Evan and Mike with my headphones plugged into the desktop computer. I mean, it's a different world now, obviously. That's why I'm doing it, basically. It's kind of like some sort of grand, very grand reciprocation.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for so long that I think that if I would have actually wanted to kind of go pro with it, I probably missed the boat about 7 years ago. Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, it's like, I probably wouldn't mind working in the game industry in some capacity, but probably more in like a development or production capacity than anything else. But at the same time, I kind of know the industry, and I've been in software development so long that there's no glamour left in it for me. Like, I know kind of the ins and outs of the job. Like, it's not like, oh my God, wouldn't it be cool to make a game? Yeah, I pretty much know how software is made, so it would depend. For the right opportunity, I would consider it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not actively looking to get into the game industry at all.
And moreover, that's not the point, yeah.
I mean,
that, you know, is it for anyone here. But...
So for the right opportunity in this case, is someone's going to offer John a ham sandwich to leave Nintendo World to port. And promise him that the budget on this website is far more balanced.
Well, the thing is, right, I mean, people, I mean, the thing you would think, right, oh, well, you know, why don't you go run a professional site? Running a professional site, there's a lot more headaches there.
It's not as much fun.
It's not. It is just not as much fun because there's a business behind it. You have layers of politics on there. You have to deal with budget.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you have to deal with all of that real life stuff at a job that just does not make it fun, that makes it a job. That's why it's a job, right? Like, they pay you to do all of that annoying, tough, tedious crap that you don't necessarily have to do. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, like, you know, as director of this site, I think I'm spoiled because I get a lot of the benefits of a lot of these professional people do, but everything is very positive. There's really few parts of my job that I'm like, oh my God, wow, that really sucks. I really hate having to, you know, work out how much money I'm going to pay these people this quarter. I don't have to do that. I just have to worry about covering games.
And obviously people are independently motivated, so it's just because they wouldn't be applying otherwise. It's a matter of channeling that as best you can, which is not something that will necessarily hold for a professional situation.
No, definitely not.
So James, what about your aspirations?
Well, I mean, I think I've alluded in the past that long-term aspirations are I'd be a researcher in the field of computer science, which is both very close to and as completely far away from the gaming industry as you can possibly be at the same time. Because it moves from my research area in the past, and it probably would be if I ever got back into researching, would be artificial intelligence, which you can say, well, that's really closely related, except from a computer science standpoint, artificial intelligence is all like math problems.
Yeah.
Whereas from a game development standpoint, it's like, all right, they're going to duck behind the box before they start shooting, and then they're going to pop out and shoot, and then they're going to get back behind the box.
Yeah, it's more applied in game development.
Whereas in theory, it's more like, all right, here's a math equation that's 500 characters long, and it's almost all Greek letters. Apply this to learning how to count. Oh.
Alpha means three different things in this equation.
Yeah. All right, that's big alpha, that's little alpha, and that's italicized alpha.
Yeah.
What?
Alpha sub L.
Yeah, it's horrible.
My long-term aspiration is somewhat more mundane. One day, if they still exist, I will be the general manager of the Buffalo Bills.
Well, don't worry. There's probably
I just have to
line.
Wait until I'm 70 and have developed a strong southern twang. And then
when they move
job.
To London, that'll be a lot more easier for you to move into.
London, Ontario.
No, it's not that no dice. It's only happening if I have to go and bring the title to Buffalo. They deserve it.
Okay. I don't know if I can speak for all four of us, but me personally, the reason that I've done this for 11 years is that I just really get off on it. And, I mean, not in a gross way.
Nobody was even going there.
Not in a gross way, although there's nothing wrong with
no,
people.
But you know, in kind of a Schwarzenegger pumping iron way.
The pump.
I'm not sure I'd want to go there either.
Yeah, he does say the pump is like coming. That is one of the memorable quotes yes. from that film.
But like, you know, a couple days ago when we were doing the whole media summit thing and following along and seeing our staff work together and coordinate and get some of the best coverage on the internet online as soon as possible. It's amazing. The camaraderie working in with a group is so much better than when I used to do the informant pretty much alone. And working with a staff is very appealing to me. Working with other people, getting their input, getting their help, working with them and tossing around ideas and creating things together. That's why I love doing the podcast, is that I feel like this is a group effort and we create it together, and it exists because of the exact chemistry of the people that we have on here. And it's really thrilling to me to see what happens every time. And so that's why I keep doing it. It's very selfish in a way. I mean, the reason I started doing The Informant back in late 98, early 99, the reason I got the idea was that, you know, back in the late 90s, we didn't have the well-developed internet media that we do now. And there was a lot of misinformation out there. And
oh,
people
yeah.
were getting... Yeah, this is back in the era where people thought you could actually get the Triforce in Ocarina of Time.
Oh, yeah, because somebody MS painted the gold onto the image of
right.
people having it.
And so I felt like we needed people who actually had a clear mind about this stuff and who would actually spend the time to do the research to prove it one way or the other. And so I got involved with that because I felt like we had a certain responsibility or that, you know, people would be well served by having legitimate information out there. And over time, I found that the more interesting aspect of it was the analysis. You know, it was using my experience and my research and my time and whatever expertise I've developed over the years to kind of bring some kind of discussion aspect to it. And so I got more and more interested in that part of it, you know, editorializing and blogging and podcasting and whatever. And so it sort of developed into that over time. But from the beginning, it was informing people. You know, it's teaching. And I have I'm very much a teacher at heart. That's kind of the personality that I am. And I get a big thrill out of that. I get a big adrenaline rush out of teaching someone and seeing someone's eyes light up. It's hard over the internet because you can't actually see that, but you learn to
yeah.
deal
well,
with it.
If you were in person, James would have learned to love Metroid Prime by now.
Yeah. Please, somebody teach him.
Yeah.
For all of us.
I love the idea that I can explain something or that I can phrase something in a way that someone will understand it a different way. So that's why I do it, and that's why I will continue to do it as long as it's practical for me to do so. And I have no higher calling in game than to do this show. So the next letter is from Dave, who writes, "Hi RFN crew, I just want to start by saying thanks. Thank you for putting together a high-quality podcast that I look forward to every week. This is my first time writing you all, though I have been a lurker, so to speak, for about 2.5 years now. I'm writing because I recently crystallized my thoughts as to why I listen to you every week. You all love games, and it truly shines through when you discuss them. Plenty of the big podcasts out there talk about games, but it all seems generally empty or silly most of the time, especially considering how grumpy and cynical other podcasts tend to be about games. The best example of this would be to contrast episode 183 with other best of discussions. At no point do you hate on any of the games you discuss, even though you need to be selective. You keep it positive, and I really appreciate that. This is not to say that you're all not deeply thoughtful and critical of games. I've always found your discussions insightful, whether discussing the missteps of the Mystery Dungeon games or...
No!
James' characterization of the missteps being that they are released.
Yeah, they were made.
Breathe, James, breathe.
The missteps are that I might not have to take steps to complete a level.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Continuing. Or the triumphs of a masterpiece like Metroid Prime.
I'm being trolled subtly by this letter, apparently.
It's all about you, James.
Beautiful long-distance trolling.
Okay. Okay, let me finish. Quote, I am a critical thinker at heart. I am a neuroscientist, believe it or not. And I'm drawn to people who really think deeply about all aspects of a game, from gameplay mechanics to atmosphere. End quote.
And
I was like Dave here, because as much as I love the podcast and my time listening to it before, as I expressed before, I never emailed in. I mean, which is to my shame, really, as I am now finding out sometimes, you know, and you would like to hear from
my
people.
Odds of getting read were actually really good.
Yeah, I mean, it's just funny. Just I remember like back in the day when we used to sit here and we'd just be like, damn, we have no reader mail whatsoever. And we would read like the three crappiest questions you could find.
It was never that. You're exaggerating. It was never I should have emailed it. I think a lot of the time I'd listen to an episode on the train, and I'd have a good idea for a question, and then the subsequent monotony would beat it out of my head, and I'd forget.
Yeah.
And that's probably what happens to a lot of people.
There were some pretty lean episodes, though, I will say.
I did email the bag at one point, but I don't remember what the question was. And I remember it was
I think really this goes to some of the things, you know, what I always got out of the podcast, and you know, still get out of other podcasts and just talking to the three of you every week. It's the shared experience and the shared sort of insight, and sometimes the contrast when you are talking about people who are, you know, have this common interest, a common passion, really. It's just something comforting and interesting about feeling connected, really.
It's part of growing up for me, because I was talking to a friend, actually, a childhood friend, and his name is Gabriel, and I remember one of his birthday parties when he was probably turning 10 or 11 or 12, and we had a birthday party, like a sleepover party at his place, and we rented Final Fantasy VI, because, well, it was Final Fantasy III in America, because it had just come out, and we rented it and played it collectively all night until we all just fell asleep. And we got to that part where the returners are kind of on the raft and you fight Ultro or something like that, whatever his name is. And I just think, like, I cannot imagine a group of friends now who I could sit around and play Final Fantasy with all night long, except you guys.
No,
I and that's what
it
feels like.
I'm
it's
sorry.
Like every week, it's such a release of nerdiness for me to sit here and talk to you guys every week.
See, for me, gaming is not intensely solitary. It sounds a bit pathetic, but it's a solitary experience. It's something I do on my own time.
My non-Smash Brothers game.
So for me, it's a chance to come back out of that sort of shell I put around
myself.
Yeah, and
just adds another dimension to the experience, really, doesn't it? You know, kind of, there's an element of affirmation in it, I suppose, really. As well.
Stuart Smalley.
It's funny, because I recognize going in a lot of times, I'm going to be talking about a game that nobody here will have played.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really matter that much, unless John's being an asshole. Then it might matter a little bit. But generally speaking,
so
it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. I can still talk about it. You can still have a meaningful conversation.
That's the thing. I mean, I like hearing about games that I probably wouldn't be interested in from you guys, like Ace Combat. I probably wouldn't play that game, but, you know, James will mention it at least two or three times every episode, so...
Bullshit, you've already mentioned it more times than I have today.
Yeah.
I like talking to you guys for the same reason that I like listening to other podcasts, and that I like hearing about games that I might not know anything about otherwise, and I might not ever even play them. And I might not even ever consider playing them. But it's kind of nice to get this window into other people's experiences and to get a feel for what they like, even if I don't like it. It's kind of interesting to broaden my horizons a little bit. So there wasn't really a question in this email, but thank
statement.
You very much today for writing it. It's very, very kind of you to say all that stuff. And Greg has the next email.
Okay, so Brent writes... I've been following the podcast for quite a while. I have to thank you because there are several games I may never have played if I hadn't heard you talk about them on the show, Zelda 2 and Henry Hatsworth being the two biggest standouts. Anyway, on to my questions. You guys have talked about your dislike of Metroid Fusion several times, but I don't think you've ever talked about it in depth. I know you all don't like all the dialogue and talking computer BS, but how do you feel about the rest of the game?
I guess my actual... First of all, I should say I do actually like Metroid Fusion. I've played through
it
multiple
times. I
like
it quite a lot too, yeah.
I don't like it as much as the previous game, which would be Super Metroid.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really enjoyed it the first time through. I find it very, very absorbing, and I have played it since. I still think it's a good game. I mean, I think it's just not as excellent as Super Metroid and Metroid Zero Mission, really. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what it comes down to. And yeah, some of that is the personal preference of... You know, the way it's more sort of linearly guided structure and the dialogue and all that. You know, and that is something that I could probably do without. And some of it is other things. Like, I think the art style is not as elegant as Zero Mission for a handheld. It was in that phase prior to the GBA SP where, you know, everything kind of got ridiculously garish.
Yeah,
you know,
I think
like... Castlevania... Harmony of Dissonance suffered from this as well.
Disco colors.
Yeah, a whole lot of purples and greens on the same screen kind of thing.
And it's like, you know, I talked about this in the submission. I talked about this in the submission for the Games of the Decade, but with Zero Mission, you know, it had this comic book element to its bright color, but it was flashes. It was like little bits of it, you know. It was still kind of, for me, felt like Metroid, but just sort of a bit more expressive, whereas the scenery in Fusion was just so kind of colorful and everything. It kind of lost a bit of its edge there. Mm-hmm. And I guess also really some of the level designs, yeah, probably it didn't feel quite as interconnected as the worlds in Zero Mission and Super Metroid either. I mean, those would be probably my main issues, but I still feel it is a very, very good game.
John and James, did you both play Fusion?
Oh, yeah.
Long time ago.
Yeah, it feels like forever ago that I played it, but I feel the same thing. I just remember it as being very kind of garish and kind of straying away from that typical Metroid formula a little bit too much for my taste. I still really enjoyed it, but... I don't know. It just seemed like they were kind of trying to take it in a different direction a little bit.
There was some cool stuff. I mean, I liked... There was a part towards the end of the game where all of a sudden the computer couldn't tell you where to go. And it was like, you kind of went back more into kind of traditional Metroid territory. It was like, okay, I'm going to have to find my own way out of this.
And it does open up a lot by the end of the game.
So that was cool. You know, maybe they could have balanced that a little differently and have similar sort of thing happen more than once, or, you know, just open it up earlier or something might have done better. Also, the encounters with the evil SAX character were quite memorable.
I love them.
The sort of being pursued by this evil clone of yourself that you just can't hope to beat, at least, you know, until the climax of the game. You're really quite well done. And the sound effects are excellent. It's probably the most memorable sound effects in a GBA game for me. The missiles, everything had this real heavy crunch to them. It just sounded great.
I think the stealth parts are really, really good. And actually, Zero Mission tries to... I mean, it has that whole Zero Suit segment at the end where it's kind of trying to pull together those feelings of helplessness and, you know, sneaking around. But I actually think it never quite lives up to the stealth feeling of Fusion.
Because Fusion did it in smaller chunks, which I think is more effective.
Yeah, and sometimes they would even surprise you a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, with Zero Mission, I really like the payoff. Yeah, when you get the fully powered suit back and
that's
absolutely
awesome.
Demolish everyone. It was worth it for the payoff.
But the actual stealth part in Zero Mission is kind of frustrating.
It's certainly frustrating. I think the smaller doses in Fusion were probably a better way of doing it. But like I said, what you don't get then is this sort of cathartic, I'm back, baby, suck it, kind of moment, you know? There was a reason behind that, I think, in Zero Mission all the same.
But before we move on, I just want to say that my criticism about Fusion, and this goes all the way, even if you go back and read my review of the game, which when it came out, I gave it a very positive review. I mean, it
was... As did just about everyone for the record.
Sure. I mean, it was the first Metroid game we'd had in 10 years.
Well, not 10 years. It was 8 years.
I'm sorry, not quite 10 years, but it had been a very long time. And,
sure.
Especially in 2D Metroid, it was really exciting to get back into that. Really, the only thing we had in the interim was probably Symphony of the Night, which is quite different in a lot of ways.
It
was exciting to get back into Fusion, and, you know, it was exciting to be playing a new Metroid game, especially in 2D. My problem with it is that I was really excited, especially when I saw the original video for Metroid 4, which probably was at E3 2000 or 2001.
Yeah.
I mean, you think Fusion is garish. Look up this video. I'm sure it's on YouTube or something somewhere.
Right. Just the font. Do you remember what that Metroid 4 looked like? It looked crazy.
Everything was really neon about it. Like, neon and flashing. It looked like a bad, like, web page circa 1993. and they showed a lot of very strange stuff, like Samus running on the ceiling and running on the walls, which actually, ironically, would be reprised in Shadow Complex eventually. But... that stuff eventually did not make it into Fusion, but my problem with the game is that I felt like it was a really big narrative opportunity for Metroid to kind of move in a different direction because Samus had been fused with a Metroid. I mean, that's in the very title of the game, and it's certainly in the whole story framework is that, you know, this Metroid stuff has been injected into Samus, and now she's part Metroid. And I'd never really felt like they made good use of that. I mean, they introduced this virus that she can absorb.
It was just an elegant way of having missile and health pickups be rationalized.
Yeah. It doesn't really change the game all that much in terms of how you play
it. The real
it.
Thing was just like, would you have a meaningfully different ability set? And at the end
exactly.
of the day, it isn't. It's very comparable to Super Metroid before and Zero Mission after.
Right. And there's actually a superficial change in Samus's abilities because she is now part Metroid is that she's very weak to cold.
Yeah,
and that's one of my favorite things about the game is that they treat this, you know, there's a section of the space station that's really cold, and they treat it basically as if it was hot, because it might as well be. I mean, for a Metroid, cold is very dangerous. And so when you eventually get the Varia suit, you know, it protects you from both the cold and the heat. And when Samus eventually gets the ice ability, instead of becoming an ice beam, they say, well, that's not really compatible with your beam weapon because you are now part Metroid. So we've instead infused your missiles with ice. I mean, I think that's actually a really, really good use of the narrative structure that they'd put forward. And I just wanted a lot more in that vein because in the end, there's not really any kind of upgrade or ability. There's not any really functional difference in the way the game plays.
The biggest difference is they found a mechanism for making her suit as garish as the rest of the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was... And I didn't really like that suit redesign either. I mean, it's...
It's kind of ugly.
The sprite and the animations, all that. I mean, Zero Mission, I think, is a very significant improvement.
In artwork, yes. I mean, that's eventually... Ultimately, that's my... only major complaint about Fusion is that it just seems like a lost opportunity.
It seems like they backed out, to be honest. You know, like you said with the video, it just seems like they went so far down that road and they thought, this isn't real. Let's rein it back in a bit and make it more conventional.
In the end, it's not the stuff that you might expect that would bother me in terms of the narrative, the fact that Samus has kind of an inner monologue or whatever. The fact that they're introducing characters like this computer that's named after her former commander and that there's all this story stuff built into it.
It is a spectacular. I mean, it's so silly. It's just like, this computer reminds me of my old commander. I'll kind of refer to it as shorthand. Yeah. And then later on, it's like, holy shit, it is my old commander with his brain downloaded to a computer. I didn't know that.
It's kind of dumb, but that stuff doesn't really bother me. It's more about the gameplay for me. The story stuff, and it's not overbearing in Fusion. I mean, it's there, but whatever. If I really hated it, I could still ignore it. And the fact is, I don't hate it. It just doesn't. It doesn't dramatically improve the game.
It doesn't enhance the stuff. I mean, I think some of the, I mean, the more effective stuff in some of it is the sum of the sequences where, you know, like doors will get locked or things will happen. You know, I kind of like the idea that, you know, to some extent you were in the middle of something that was ongoing, that was kind of happening, that was a situation that was
waiting for you to show up.
Yeah, so I kind of like some of that kind of stuff, but sometimes that amounted to the experience being a bit more funneled than I would have liked as well. Mm-hmm. So it, the kind of good came with the bad with that.
All right. So, Greg, maybe you can finish Brent's letter.
Yeah, I will
now.
Pick up the answer. So Brent had another question, which was, I think an old-school RPG with single-handed controls would be great on the Wii. Considering that all an RPG really needs is a D-pad and one or two buttons for menus, I think it would be a much more relaxed and enjoyable way to play. Just wondering if you have any thoughts on this, or if you've heard of any of the games using this control method. I think it would have been great for Fire Emblem. Anyway, thanks for the great show. It makes the work night go by faster.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. And as far as Fire Emblem, I think I never played the Fire Emblem for Wii.
You need two hands for Fire Emblem, because you need one to crush the controller in your hand out of the frame. And you need the other one to then pick the pieces of plastic out of the hand that you just crushed.
Well, exactly. One has to throw it against the wall, and then the other, you know, the other one has to give the thing the finger.
The other has to realize, oh shit, it was tethered.
Yep.
Well, I remember reading a lot of criticisms of that game, which, is it Radiant Dawn?
Yes.
Or was that the GameCube one?
Because it was Emblem. Path of Radiance and Radiant Dawn, wasn't it?
Okay. Path of Radiance is the GameCube, and then Radiant Dawn is the, is the Wii title.
Hey, that's a great subtitle. But what I heard about the Wii version, Radiant Dawn, is that because it didn't actually use the Wii remote in any meaningful way, in other words, you couldn't even point at the screen to select your menus. And
Thank you!
You basically had to play it NES style, or maybe with a classic controller or a GameCube controller. And so it felt like there was, again, a sort of a missed opportunity to make the controls more elegant. And so they didn't actually do that.
But they missed a massive opportunity to make the control.
Yeah. The only Wii game that I can think of that seems that reductive in terms of being, you know, sort of an RPG and allowing you to control it in a very, very simple way is an old early Wii game called Opuna.
Oh.
And you can play it with only the nunchuck.
Yes.
But it's weird because it does have this kind of Super Mario RPG or Paper Mario kind of action battle system, but it's all using the nunchuck or the joystick on the nunchuck. So basically you only need you only need the two buttons on the nunchuck to navigate the menus, and then use the joystick to select the menus as well as do whatever action items are required, you know, for your attacks and defense. But I don't think that game's very good.
Now, I've never played it, but what about Dragon Quest Swords? How RPG-ish is that?
But that's like,
I mean, I know it's basically a sword fighting simulator, but
when we're talking about a sort of relaxed game, I don't think we're talking about slashing over the place.
Oh, that's the thing. I mean, Dragon Quest Swords is actually a really fun little game. I mean, it is kind of a minor game. It's a game I would say, if you see it for a low price, pick it up, because it's actually good.
But it's not really an RPG.
It's not really. I mean, it's kind of an action game with some RPG trappings, and it won't last you that long, and it's not a very deep experience, but it's quite enjoyable for what it is, and again, it's worth playing.
But it goes back to when you talked about it with Super Mario RPG last week, didn't you? Was it a Paladin's Quest or with a D-pad or whatever? It is something that appeals to me. I mean, RPGs for me, I mean, I would generally prefer to play them on portables because it's the portable is more of a kind of casual experience for different reasons. You may well be, you know, gripping it with both hands or whatever, but, you know, you can kind of have the TV on at the same time or whatever.
Yeah.
But this is a similar sort of vibe to that, but just with a console in the sense that you don't have to be, you know, too involved, or it's kind of relaxing. I mean, with Endless Ocean, for instance, you could just use the remote. And one way I look at that is, you know, that is a really casual game because you actually play it casually. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you just, you know, one hand kind of just generally waving around in the direction you want to go in, you know, something like that. Now, RPGs, you're going to be a bit more involved than that, probably.
Well, I mean, speaking of that, Endless Ocean Blue World, from what Neil said in his review, it's a lot like a JRPG.
The sequel especially, it's got some RPG kind of trappings to it, so maybe you could say Endless Ocean fills this criteria.
Yeah.
I think there's a gap for it in some ways, but I don't know that it's necessarily being filled.
I don't think it is, really. But I do remember that, man, a long time ago in the 90s, there was a controller that I used to see in magazines. I never actually got to use one. but I think it was for the original PlayStation. There might have been a version for Super Nintendo, but I think the main version was for PlayStation 1. And it was a controller specifically made for RPGs that you could hold in one hand. It looked a lot like a nunchuck, but with a lot more buttons. So it had a D-pad on it instead of a joystick. And it had, you know, basically face buttons for, you know, all the things that you would need right there. And then it had a lot of buttons that you use with your index and your middle fingers. And it was specifically made for RPGs, and it was designed so that you could play a fairly simple game that didn't require really fast reflexes with one hand.
Yeah, but it looks silly.
And plus it was unidirectional, so you could use it with either your left or your right hand. It didn't matter, basically. And I always thought it was a cool idea. I never owned enough games that I felt like it would have been a good investment. Mm-hmm. But I always thought it was a really cool idea. It's a nice thought that you could kind of play a game with one hand and just not give a shit and hold your beer in the other one.
It's the kind of thing I could kind of imagine, maybe, like, if they ever did make, like, another console Earthbound game or something, it would kind of fit reasonably well with the kind of vibe in that. Yeah, you know, it's not meant to be, like, epic or anything. So,
yeah.
I could make, but of course, that will probably never happen. So.
Yeah. I'm surprised the Dead or Alive games don't support one-handed control.
Well, you know, I snickered about halfway through this question.
We had
like,
to go there.
It's not going to make the joke.
There's the housekeeping done. There you go.
Chowaniki, for that matter. Hey, who
no,
why not? I mean, you know, you set me
you
up, Johnny.
You could easily play Chowaniki with one hand. I mean, it's not a complicated game. So, James has the final question.
Okay. Max writes, "Hey guys, I'm very disappointed you chose Majora's Mask over Wind Waker. I'm not voting in the poll because I'm so disgusted with your choice. I did not like Majora because I like to take my time and explore everything instead of being rushed to beat the dungeons and finish the game. I really love listening to your podcast and can't wait each week until the next episode. I've been listening regularly, almost religiously, for the last 1.5 years and have loved every hour or two of you guys talking. I rated your podcast 5 stars and also left a favorite review on iTunes."
Check is in the mail.
Thanks very much, Max, for doing that. And I'm sorry we disappointed you. I hope hopefully by now you've heard episode 183 and you understand our reasoning behind that decision. But, you know, part of the whole point of doing that episode was to make some difficult decisions, and it's not that we don't like Wind Waker.
I think we were quite clear about that, but, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you get this sort of thing, because, you know, I mean,
sure.
There's strong feelings about something like Wind Waker, you know, as James yeah. said, you know, I think it has got a lot of emotional impact in it, and I think you get a lot of people who very attached to it, and I'm attached to it, so I mean I can relate to it, but you know I'm also attached to Majora's Mask, which clearly Max was not.
Yeah,
this I mean you like so you got to take it the spirit is intended, sort of a bit of fun, a celebration of the decade that was, and there is going to be strong feelings about these things.
I mean, it almost seemed from our forum thread that you had a lot of people that either liked Wind Waker and didn't like Majora's Mask, or vice versa.
Well, they were really two very different games. Majora's Mask is very much a very small, insular world you live in, and it's because it's so small that you have to really understand every detail of how it operates.
And it's busy, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of condensed. There is quite a lot going on there.
Majora's Mask is much more task-oriented than Wind Waker, which is you're basically on a boat, and you're looking for fish that jump around so you can map this stupid place and know where the hell you are.
That was one of my favorite parts of Wind Waker, is building the map.
Yeah. I think if there's one thing that kind of diminished that organic sense of the ocean was the fact that every square on the grid had one thing in it, basically, you know. So it didn't feel as once you kind of started to get a feel for how it worked, it didn't feel as organic and natural as it did to start.
Yeah, it's a little transparent. It's like, oh, they put this island here because blank.
You need something in the square, the grid reference.
Sometimes.
I guess, they had limited amount of land real estate they could work with because, you know, you're on a flooded plain.
Well, yeah, and that's one thing we didn't talk about a whole lot when we were having this discussion originally, but the actual sailing in Wind Waker, I've always been a big fan of it, actually. I mean, there are times when I would set the controller down and get up and walk away for a minute and come back.
Yeah.
I mean, I will freely admit that, but I always felt like the actual feeling of sailing was really authentically conveyed in Wind Waker. And it is a wonderful feeling, and it's partly the music, partly the graphics of seeing the kind of spray of you know, cartoon-shaded
the
water.
The sound as well. I can still hear the sound, like the crashing of the waves still sticks in my head.
It's really thrilling, I think, to set the wind and just go.
I agree with all of that. The thing is, it did wear off for me after a while. I mean, it's a long game. But I guess the interesting part about the ocean, in many ways, is that, you know, when you got to Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask and Twilight Princess, for that matter, you didn't have overworlds that were as dense and sort of intricate and interesting as their 2D counterparts. They were quite barren.
Yeah.
And the ocean basically said, well, we're going to completely concede that, you know, and kind of a design around it so that we don't have load times, and you know, and there's a reason for why it's so kind of desolate.
Yeah, and when you find an island, you know damn well there will be something on there.
Right, there is a reason for you to get off
there's
your damn boat.
There's a great ferry
and explore
that you need to find.
Kind of focuses your attention at little specific points. So in some ways, if you perceive that as a weakness of the 3D Zeldas, it kind of made it worse. But in another way, it made it work.
Well, it's still really amazing to me that the entire game, until you go into a dungeon, you never encounter a break, ever. Even in town, you just walk into town. You don't walk.
That's true. Pause.
I think it's a great point, James. It's just this one world, and you just move in and out of it, and there's no overworld versus town.
Which is, you know, you contrast that with Twilight Princess, where you've got discontinuity between the sections of Hyrule Castle Town.
It's one of those things. I mean, the discontinuity is it's a deliberate design decision based partly on technical limitations, but partly on scale. And Wind Waker is an example of what happens when you build the scale around the idea that you won't have any breaks. And what happens is you end up with a very large world that takes quite a long time to get across because you don't just warp from inside the town to outside the town. It's all just one place. And what you find when you build it all together in that very smooth way is that, wow, the world is really big and I don't care. I mean, that's not necessarily how I feel about it, but that's the way a lot of people feel about it.
I feel like the one great advantage that John had brought this up earlier about how even in the music you can kind of feel like you're on a boat.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny because I don't think Phantom Hourglass did as good a job of that, although certainly it's technically impressive feat that they were able to do as much as they did in one world without.
No.
But I think, I'm gonna catch hell for this, I think Spirit Tracks did a much better job of getting the feeling of you're on a train. As a person,
okay.
As a person who has ridden a train God knows how many times. It did feel like even the music sounds like the train.
Shit's
I love the music again, but that wears off a little bit.
that feeling of I want to go there, but I have to go there to go there is something that you get a lot if you're looking at train schedules.
I mean, whatever you want to debate, I mean, it's a kind of classic dilemma between Majora's Mask and Wind Waker in some ways, but whatever you want to debate about the merits of Wind Waker, all that, I really feel like the time has come for a Zelda game with a more interesting overworld again. And I don't know that this new one on Wii is going to give it to us.
Oh, I hope so.
It'll be tough, though, because you know, you're still dealing with your 3D graphics on Wii. I don't know that they can deliver it.
Think about since Twilight Princess came out, you've had really, really good examples of how to do it in games like Okami and Shadow of the Colossus, and a few others that are escaping.
Yeah, I mean,
there's
definitely a higher bar for them to reach to. But I mean, it's just that part of it, you know, which is, you know, there was two parts to Link to the Past that made me fall in love with the franchise. You know, one of it was the dungeons, and one of it was, you know, this overworld where it felt like there was just so much little, you know, secrets and stuff crammed into it to find. And for me, that's the part that they haven't been able to capture. And it's actually what I like about Minish Cap, because Minish Cap's got a cool overworld in it, I think. You know, and it's quite dense because you've got the kind of overlapping element, because there's bits you can explore shrank, and then there's bits that were just normal size. So I think Minish Cap was the last time that they really got into this stuff. And it's, you're maybe, you know, if they can't do it with the next Zelda or Wii, could we perhaps go back to an old, the, you know, this non 3D, handheld, you know, cause that's what the cell shaded look and emulating Wind Waker is all well and good for Phantom Hourglass and, Spirit Tracks, but it kind of boxed them in on the overworld where I just think, you know, was that a good trade-off overall? Debatable.
Right. Very, very debatable. Well, it's time to finish up now. But before we go, I do want to say thank you very much to everyone who wrote in with these great emails. We have quite a few left, so we'll be continue catching up on them. Don't worry. And of course, you can send your question to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We really appreciate everybody who writes in. And as always, check out the other podcasts on the NWR network. That would be Radio Trivia Podcast Edition and the NWR Newscast. You can search both of those in iTunes or whatever program you prefer to use for podcasting. And I do want to remind everybody that we're going to be at PAX East at the end of March. We're doing a live panel at PAX East. I'm extremely excited about it, and I can confirm the lineup now. It will be John, James, myself, and then as special guests we're going to have Carl Castaneda and Mike Sklins, who some of you might remember from former incarnations of this show. So it's going to be a multi-generational podcast edition. It's going to be really exciting, and we're really looking forward to not only doing the live panel, but Neil and Lauren from the NWR staff are putting together kind of a social meetup. So we're hoping to spend some quality time with the fans, with the listeners, and hopefully introduce ourselves to a lot of people who may not have heard the show before. And then we're also planning to record at least one episode outside of the panel. So we'll have a full length, you know, kind of hanging out at the hotel podcast. So it's going to be really fun. We're planning a lot, and I don't want to spill all the beans on what's going to happen, but we have some pretty grand plans for how it's going to go down. We're going to pack that 1 hour as full as we possibly can.
There will be puppets.
And I do want to say that if you are planning to show up, let us know. That would be great. And please come with one or two questions that you might want to ask, because we're planning on having a significant portion of the panel devoted to Q&A. So I'm really excited. It's getting closer and closer to the point where I can no longer make believe that it's way out in the distance. So yeah. I have to start allowing myself to actually get excited about doing this podcast live in front of an audience. It's going to be really
it's
weird.
It's only a month away now, so.
You say that, but it is sufficiently far in the future that Cave Story will actually be out.
Oh, I don't believe that for
maybe
a second.
We'll just talk about Cave Story for an hour.
That's right.
It's like the third age of Middle-earth beginning or something like that.
Right.
It's a landmark moment.
Yeah, that's coming up March 26th, I think. More, give or take a day, is the date of the live panel. It's called Radio Free Nintendo Live, a live Nintendo podcast for grown-ups. And
not that
hopefully
you'd
we haven't
John
betrayed
us.
That description
exactly.
Too much. So thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye. John, final question. Do you jump through the gate?
Damn well better.
Which gate? What gate?
Oh!
The boss gate. You have to jump through the gate.
So you freeze in air.
That's right. You freeze in this amazing animation of Mega Man with his mouth open and
his hand, one arm in the air and his legs like, yeah, it's great.
Oh, is the
like
gate?
It's like the Mary Tyler Moore show.
Yeah. The ones that does, and then it does the slow-mo movement.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think it does that in this game.
What?
No. It does.
It damn well better.
I don't.
It does. It has to.
I don't believe it does.
I will fucking... no, it has
James
to.
James and I will go on a killing rampage.
Okay, well, hold on.
I do that every single door. Even the save doors.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure it does.
I hope it doesn't, just so Johnny starts crying.
I can't handle the truth.
I want to see Oregon Trail 3 starring Evan Birchfield.
Oregon Trail. Well, it's time to finish up now. So before we go, I do want to say, or I guess I should say, well, let me start that over. I've had a lot to drink.
Stinger.